I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor to order. Today is Tuesday, October 16th. This is our first meeting, as we are all aware. And we are convening a subcommittee of the subcommittee, not having a quorum yet, so we will have to wait to adopt rules. With that, I think I will wait until we do have our quorum to make some opening remarks, but not trying to delay the process. I think we should pass the gavel to the House side so you can adopt rules and proceed. We're on a budget here.
Thank you, Senator. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection to order. As stated, it is October 16th. And our first order of business would be to adopt the Interim Committee rules for the 74th Legislative Assembly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I move that we adopt the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection rules for the 74th Legislative Assembly.
Representative Bonamici moves we adopt the interim rules for the House Consumer Protection Committee for the 74th Legislative Assembly. Any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, the rules are so adopted. At this time, I think we wanted to introduce our committee members, and we'll start to my far left.
Representative Larry Glizio, House District 35.
Representative Fred Girard, House District 17.
Representative Suzanne Bonamici, House District 34.
And I'm Representative Paul Holby, House District 8.
Great. And seeing as how the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is still in a subcommittee, status here. I don't think we want to delay and impinge on all your good hospitality. You have gotten here in time, and we will try to get through a very crowded agenda pretty quickly. A couple of things I do want to say. First of all is welcome to the House. Thank you, Paul, for agreeing to have a joint committee, and thank you for your commitment and leadership on this issue. I want to thank Teresa, our august committee staff, because she has done yeoman's work in pulling this whole thing together. And I think this is, you know, we're kind of all like a family in this, with the governor's task force on mortgage lending, the committee staff, DCBS. There's a great deal of collaboration around this issue, and Teresa, at least from my standpoint, has been the point. So thank you very much. We very much appreciate your contribution to this. But it's also implicit with the focus and the level of interest, not only in this committee, but from the governor's office, the industry itself, is that this committees will be producing legislation. We are not going to have a repeat of the 965 fiasco. I think there are reasons why that happened, and they will not be repeated here. This is a complicated and involved issue, as we all know. We don't want to do anything prematurely, but what we do will be done, and we will produce legislation to help address this issue. So with that, we'll just dive right into this as we wait for Senator Devlin to get here so we can officially adopt rules. I think everyone knows my colleague to my right, Senator Floyd Perzanski, the guy that's responsible for all the field signs you're seeing up and down the freeway. Thank you for that, Floyd.
You're welcome.
Anyway, so let's just get right into this. If I could caution the committee members, we do have a long agenda. Let's hold questions till later, and regrettably, we're going to have to limit the testimony of testifiers to presenters to about 5 minutes. I'm pretty firm on that because I'm pretty firm on my belief that everyone that's here should be heard. So with that, let me bring up Corey Streisinger and DCBS to give an overview. Thank you for being here, Corey.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on.
No,
Chair Holby.
Thank you, Chair Westland. Just for information, you know, this committee is looking specifically at the mortgage lending crisis and its impacts on Oregon. And as the co-chair has reiterated that we do have a tight agenda, I was hoping the committee could write their questions down as we go along, and either we'll have time to address those questions towards the end, or we'll refer those questions onto the governor's task force to look at our questions or comments as we go forward. We intend on having another committee hearing before November 15th on this issue to perhaps look at what this committee may look at. So with that, thank you.
Enter and sign in, please.
Thank you, co-chairs. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tatman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I've been asked to give just a little introduction about what we're seeing in the mortgage lending industry today, and I want to apologize in advance. I am not going to be able to be here for the full meeting today, but Mr. Tatman will be here, Lou Savage will be here, and, of course, we're all happy to come back later. I believe you're being passed out some materials from our department in the blue folder that's just being distributed now. I'm going to be referring to a little of those. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I think from our starting point, and it's probably a starting point shared by everybody in this room, is that a strong mortgage lending industry is critically important for Oregon. Mortgage lending is what allows Oregon families to buy and refinance homes. And that includes the subprime lending market, which allows people to have the opportunity for home ownership, even if their credit is less than stellar. So our goal is a strong mortgage lending environment, one in which people can buy and finance homes, and one in which the loans that people take out are aimed at success. They are loans that can be successfully repaid over time for the benefit both of keeping that family in the home and, of course, allowing the mortgage lender to have a successful financial transaction. In our department, we regulate mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers, as well as state chartered banks and credit unions that do mortgage lending. We do not regulate federally chartered banks and credit unions that also do some mortgage lending, and we do not regulate wholly owned mortgage lending subsidiaries of national banks. Getting your hands around the numbers of what that means is a little difficult, but the best estimates we've heard is that nationally about 65% of mortgage lending takes place in the state-regulated market. So just to give you an idea of what we are addressing today. Mortgage lending has been a concern of ours over the past couple of years, and I think for those of you who were on the session committees, we talked a little about it really at the beginning of the session when we did a departmental overview of some of what we were working on. We did see an uptick in complaints and concerns. We did a review of the program, met with industry folks, had some public forums. We heard concerns in a number of areas, one of them having to do with people not understanding the products that they were getting into, or sometimes facing themselves in a loan that had been misrepresented to them with respect to payment terms, prepayment penalties, and the like. And then we also saw a considerable uptick in non-traditional loan products, which you're going to be, of course, hearing about more, things like introductory adjustable rates that are set low and then increase substantially over a couple of years, sometimes interest-only loans or negative amortization loans where the initial payments aren't sufficient to even pay the interest, and so that the amount of principal actually expands. So we've seen in the last few months, the concern with those types of loan products was that people were getting into loans that, in fact, they couldn't afford. And what we've seen on the national level is indeed, as I'm sure you all know, a very substantial increase in foreclosures, which then has caused market repercussions, so that subprime lending really today is not available in anywhere what it has been available. Someone who has subprime credit has a great deal of difficulty today getting or refinancing a loan. And even in the prime market, underwriting standards have tightened up, and some of the types of lending practices that we saw a year ago we are not seeing today in terms of, for example, debt-to-income ratios or low documentation loans or stated asset or stated income types of loans, very much less available today. And, of course, a number of mortgage companies have either gone out of business or their business has significantly contracted. And we have seen that in Oregon as well. Just to give you some numbers, the number of loan originators registered with us, and loan originators are the people who are actually working with the borrower and doing the paperwork, the salespeople, if you will. We do register those. The number registered with us rose from 9,000 in 2002 to a peak of about 14,000 in 2005. It's now dropped to about 10,000 as of June 2007. So a loss of over 2,000 loan originators just since January, which is a drop of about 20%. We currently have licensed about 1,800 mortgage lenders as compared to 1,200 in 2002, and that number is holding fairly steady, but we have seen a drop in the number of licensed branches. So you will be hearing later this morning from others about some of the other data points, what we do and don't know about things like the types of loans, percentage of loans in the subprime market, delinquency rates, foreclosure rates. I'm not going to go into those because one of the things we have done through the mortgage lending work group that's been referred to is there's been a lot of good work done by a subgroup on data points. So I'm leaving that to them. What we have done in the department, and you will see in the packet a list of activities that have taken place in the mortgage lending arena over the last year to year and a half. We did, as, and I think a number of you are familiar with this from the discussions about Senate Bill 965, we did adopt regulatory guidelines, and I stress the word guidelines, addressing non-traditional mortgage lending products and establishing expectations for those products. And those are based on national guidelines that have been adopted at a federal level and by many states, but they are not binding. They do not have the force of law. We increased our mortgage lending examination staff, and David's going to talk, I think, in the second part of the agenda that he's on about what we do in terms of enforcement. But we added staff. We began examining out-of-state mortgage lenders rather than just those located in-state. We adopted new rules on mortgage loan originator education. Previously, the loan originator had to meet the education requirements within their first 6 months of doing business, but they could actually start originating loans before becoming qualified. We now have required them to do the education and pass their test before they begin originating loans. We have new rules in place increasing supervision and oversight requirements over loan originators by the mortgage lenders who employ them. We have a new testing administrator, again, toughening up those standards. We have stepped up our enforcement activity, and we have also stepped up our focus on misleading advertising, particularly in the area of refinancing, and any of you who have mortgages probably get some of those letters on an ongoing basis. We are also, as we look forward, and again, you'll hear about this later today, we are concerned about the potential foreclosures coming in the future. We have stepped up educational efforts. We have a brochure about how to avoid foreclosure, which you'll see in your materials. And we are partnering with some national organizations to make available pre-foreclosure counseling. One of the things that we have learned is that upwards of 50% of people who face foreclosure never contact their lender. And actually contacting the lender and engaging in discussions about options is one of the most important things that a borrower in delinquency can do, because foreclosure does not benefit the lender any more than it benefits the borrower. So we want to try to increase visibility, and that's something that we're going to be looking at as we move forward as well. Another topic area, which you will hear more about and which the work group is looking at, is the area of the so-called mortgage rescue schemes. I'm not going to go into detail of those. Those of you who have been participating in the work group have heard some about what's going on, but we are concerned about a phenomenon that has occurred in a number of other states that have seen high foreclosure rates. We're starting to see bits of it here, and that is people who come in and engage in a transaction with someone who is potentially facing foreclosure that may end up with that person not understanding the terms, ultimately losing their home when they thought that the transaction was going to help them keep their home. So that's an area that we are also continuing to look at. The governor did, as you know, ask us to pull together a work group to look at a number of areas, not only the short-term areas like these mortgage rescue schemes, foreclosure laws and whether people are given appropriate information about their options and their rights, but then also on the longer term, what should we be thinking about to ensure that we have a strong mortgage lending market for the future and one that produces the loans that people have the ability to repay. I think we all believe that the subprime market will return, and when it does, we want it to be a strong market with appropriate sets of protections. You have copies of the governor's charge to the work group in your materials. Again, I'm not going to go through that detail today because you will be hearing a lot more about it as we move forward. The work group has met several times. We've had several work groups that have also met. Next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, and a number of the participants in the work group are going to be here to talk to you later today. So that's my brief overview. I am happy to answer any questions, and I know, Mr. Chair, you had suggested reserving questions for later, and I'm happy to come back at a future time if there's questions for me later today. But if there's anything I can answer for you right now, of course, I'd be happy to do that.
If I could just stop the proceedings momentarily and close the subcommittee on the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor and open the first official committee of the Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor and ask for a motion to adopt rules from Senator Prozanski.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the proposed rule, committee rules that are set forth in the document dated October 2007 for the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We are officially off and running. Excuse me, Corey. Please proceed.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I had actually concluded my remarks for this morning, except to the extent that there are questions. And I think David is going to be back up to talk about enforcement in a few minutes. So we are at your disposal, or we can move on to the next item on
the
agenda.
Let's move on. Mr. Chair, as we're setting up, I just want to alert the committee. I've been, let's say, double booked today. There's another committee that's starting at 9:30, so I will be leaving the room to help them get their rules adopted. And we'll be going back and forth if that's permissible from the two co-chairs.
Likewise, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I need to run over to the other committee for a brief appearance, and we'll return.
This is effective and efficient government at work before your eyes. Okay. Look at all the per diem we're saving.
Yeah, one per diem. Two committees. It's a twofer.
Yeah. I'd like to call up the governor's mortgage lending work group, the subcommittee reports. I don't know if both these individuals want to come up together, but we have the mortgage lending data subcommittee, Angela Martin, and then also, let's bring them up together for both subgroups. Chris Ambrose with the mortgage rescue subcommittee. And then, Angela, I think you're going to be coming back up. This is an overview from the governor's task force and some subcommittees that were formed to help get into deeper depth of data. So, Angela, why don't you proceed?
I'll For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon. And I'm going to start by saying that we decided yesterday that we did not accomplish the level of work we had anticipated accomplishing in order to present a full report of the data subcommittee. So that report will be forthcoming for everyone's review. I'll turn to Chris and see if he had additional figures that he wanted to add or comments.
On the data subcommittee, I don't. Thank you.
It's the report that wasn't.
Mr. Chair. Angela, could you just give us an overview of the task force and, you know, what this committee is looking at, perhaps to familiarize some of the members that aren't on that task force
Thank you, Chair.
with what's going on.
Appreciate the question. The subcommittee on data was called together so that we could have the opportunity to get that 360-degree view of what's happening with foreclosures in Oregon. What's happening with foreclosures in comparison to other states? How do we rank with other states nationally? What is happening with foreclosures within Oregon, both historically and regionally? And then finally, what are the predictions for the future? How are subprime loans performing? How have they performed in the past? How do we anticipate that they'll be performing in the future? The subcommittee was put to work to accomplish a few things. First off, look at the data sources and come back to the committee with a description of the various data sources available, highlighting the pros and cons of each of those sources, because each of them tells a slightly different story, and we need to understand what that story is. The group was also asked to look at various ways of measuring subprime foreclosures, measuring the problem. So they'll take two different approaches to looking at how we can determine how folks are faring in that market.
Good morning, senators, representatives. My name is Chris Ambrose of Ambrose Law Group. I'm this year's president of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, which is an affiliate of the National Mortgage Bankers Association. And I'm here this morning. I will be testifying later this afternoon on behalf of the OMLA, but I'm here this morning to give a report regarding the Mortgage Rescue Subcommittee. I'm also serving with Angela on the Data Subcommittee, which has perused, examined an inordinate amount of data, and I believe a great amount of work has been accomplished thus far for that committee. Unfortunately, as you might imagine, there are some disagreements regarding the nature and extent of the data and what we can ultimately do with it. On the other hand, the Mortgage Rescue Subcommittee is progressing nicely. There are, at this point in time, I believe I can safely say, not a lot of disagreement regarding what ultimately may be proposed to the general task force. There are a few issues that are going to be brought up before the task force tomorrow's meeting. But there is a general consensus on the bulk of what ultimately might go into a mortgage rescue operation. For those of you who aren't aware, the mortgage rescue scams or operations is essentially a situation. It comes at it from a number of different perspectives, but by and large, it's where somebody is advertising, for example, to save a borrower's house, save a homeowner's house. And there are a number of different schemes that are then put into effect in order to, what's at least from the homeowner's perspective, perceived to be a measure to enable them to not only cure their default to save their home, but to ultimately stay in their home long term without having to sell it. Those can be as simple as simply asking for a cash payment up front, anywhere from $600 to we've seen as high as $5,000. The person, the borrower that is, gives over the money, and then the money disappears. It can get then ultimately to the lease option situation, where the borrower is being told that they will be able to, if they deed over the property, they will be able to remain in the property, rent the property, and then ultimately have the opportunity to purchase it. I will say that there are a number of what seemingly are credible companies out there that are engaging in lease option operations, but there certainly are many that are taking advantage of the homeowners, and that's particularly what we're trying to address by this
legislation, proposed legislation. Approximately 9 states have implemented some type of mortgage rescue operations at this point in time, so we're not, fortunately, having to start from scratch. We've been able to have discussions with the other states about what works, what hasn't worked, and again, without going through all the bullet points in the report summary, by and large, I believe there's a general agreement regarding what ultimately may go into proposed legislation. There are a couple different issues that, again, we'll be bringing up with the task force tomorrow in detail. For example, on the lease option side, what should there be a restriction on the purchase price that the homeowner sells the property for? And should there be a restriction on the back end, what the purchase price should be if the homeowner is in a position to be able to afford to repurchase the home somewhere down the line. There is a broad spectrum of options available, ranging from a payment of a certain percentage of the net proceeds to the homeowner if the purchase if the home is sold within a certain number of months, and so on. So again, we'll be presenting that to the group tomorrow. Finally, I should emphasize that we are addressing this in a twofold aspect. One is just a pure foreclosure consultant, that individual that is trying to save the house, and then on the back end, that individual or company that may be coming forward to indicate that they're going to have the property deeded to them or ultimately lease optioned. So with that, I will conclude, and we'll certainly be happy to answer any questions later. Thank you.
Right. Thank you both.
Now, the thought, not the thought, just occurs to me, but one of the things I'm concerned about as we go forward, this is obviously an incredibly complex area. And I think Corey said it very well when she said, you know, we need and value the mortgage lending industry. It's an essential component in the economic vibrancy of this state. And I think that goes without saying. I think every member of the committee would agree with that statement. But what I don't want to get into is a morass of conflicting data that lends us to, excuse the pun, to inaction. Because my simple statement is this. If someone thinks, well, I'll just speak for myself. No. If someone thinks that this isn't a problem, then they're wrong. There are egregious examples, and unfortunately, example after example after example out there. You don't get the Fed dropping 50 basis points because this isn't a national crisis. It is. And the worst is yet to come. So we collectively, this is all of our call to action. And I know the people sitting in this room reflect the best and the brightest of the industry. So we've got to all pull together. But part of it is also enforcement of existing rules that are already on the books. And that's the segue to the next part of the presentation, current enforcement, and what authority and tools do we have. And so with that, let me call up Andrew Shaw, David Tartman. You might as well all come on up together. Take your pick. Enter and sign in, please.
Chairs, Holvey and Westland, and members of the committee, thank you. Andrew Shaw, Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, Oregon Department of Justice. Mr. Tapman, unfortunately, is going to get the brunt of this presentation, and this is because some appellate cases that are out there in Oregon. As most of you are aware, our primary consumer protection tool in the state is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The vast majority of our consumer protection settlements and actions and judgments are pursuant to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. There are a series of appellate cases out there that essentially hold loans or the extension of credit are excluded from the purview of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. There are exceptions with some purchase agreement loans involving, you know, buying used cars, etc. But in a nutshell, these cases say lenders or non-lenders, material non-disclosures or misrepresentations of a loan's attributes are not actionable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And just for the record, I'll quickly mention the cases Hager v. Johnson, 1976, Lamb v. Amfac Mortgage Corporation, 1980, Cullen v. Investment Strategies, 1996. These cases do also make clear, however, that non-lenders, material non-disclosures, or misrepresentations regarding character, quality, or cost of services of the non-lender are actionable. The most common example of this is a independent residential mortgage broker. The Attorney General has participated, along with the assistance of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, in two recent significant multi-state mortgage lending settlements. This was Household International in 2002 and Ameriquest in 2006. These were settlements in which virtually all the states participated, both on a regulatory side, such as DCBS, and with the attorney generals of those states. The Department of Justice was involved due largely to the company's interest in a global or near-global resolution across the nation. It gave them certainty as opposed to the unknown. The more states and the more entities that are willing to participate in those settlements. These settlements were massive. Even for Oregon, they did amazing things for Oregon consumers. It was a lot of work for the multi-state, for DCBS, and for the Attorney General's office, and a lot of consumers benefited. Since they rarely, if ever, involve extensions of credit or loans, as people have alluded to, there is a problem on the back end known as rescue mortgage schemes or rescue mortgage operators. These do fall under the purview of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We do take actions against those operators that are seen as acting in violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and are egregious and effectively have a pattern of affecting consumers in Oregon. Our investigations of these foreclosure schemes typically discover evidence of misrepresentations, failure to disclose, and in the most egregious situations, unconscionability. Again, these are all items that are actionable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So if there are patterns of unlawful conduct by these operators, if there's threat or likely threat to many Oregonians or any other factors that justify action by the Attorney General, those actions are taken under the UTPA. Typically, these result in assurances of voluntary compliance. For those of you that aren't familiar with that mechanism, it's a statutory settlement mechanism that parties can enter into in lieu of litigation. These assurances of voluntary compliance with rescue scheme operators typically involve permanent injunctions against misleading conduct going forward. They do, however, and they have recently involved prohibitions against the entities because of their egregious activity from doing any foreclosure rescue activity in the state of Oregon. And just really briefly, I do want to stress that the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Section comes across these rescue schemes in worst-case scenarios. Things have gone terribly wrong by the time a consumer contacts us in most cases. They're under threat of losing their home, or they've already lost their home, and they feel like they've been taken advantage of. So as Mr. Ambrose most recently just alluded to, what the subcommittee is looking at, which the Consumer Protection Section is a part of, is a more front-end regulatory scheme to sort of rein in and to separate the bad operators from the good operators in the rescue, foreclosure rescue operations arena. So with that, I'm going to hand you over to Mr. Tatman. I can't answer questions. Thank you.
Comment, Mr. Co-Chair?
Go ahead and proceed, David.
Mr. Chair, members of the two committees. My name is David Tatman, and I'm with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'm the administrator for that division, which is part of Corey's Department of Consumer Business Services. I want to thank all of you for being here. This is a busy day for many of us. Mr. Shule reminded me that this is the start of the top-off exercise that's going on in Portland, and a number of people, including Director Streisinger, has to they've got split responsibilities today. So thank you for taking the time to have this important conversation. I'm here to talk a little bit about enforcement within the purview of the mortgage lending area. As a regulatory agency, our responsibility is to enforce through the regulatory process. And I know several of you have been at the hearings that have been held with the work group, but some of you haven't, so I'm going to see if I can hit the right mark. Let me know if I've dropped too low or I'm flying too high. But our perspective is that the division has a number of tools in its toolbox to work with both the public and the industries. And I think it's important to remember that we are working with both those stakeholder groups. Much of what we're hearing is that a number of people who have gotten into situations maybe didn't understand what they were getting into, or didn't understand the repercussions of what that loan was going to look like, or didn't understand what their options were when they got to the foreclosure notification. And so that's an important piece for us right there. How do we work with our public stakeholders? And so one of our jobs is to educate and to try and reach out and provide information. The information that Ms. Streisinger provided to you, it contained two things that I think are important. One, there's a foreclosure brochure. We took a run at this last spring. We got ahead of this, and I'm very pleased with my staff for getting ahead of this. And they've put out a brochure both in English and in Spanish to address this very issue. And it talks about options. The most important option and the one that doesn't get exercised the most is to go and talk with the lender. The borrower needs to make sure that they are protecting themselves when they get this notification. Another piece of education is, of course, work with our industry stakeholders. And you have in there a newsletter. We've started putting out a newsletter on a quarterly basis. And in that newsletter, we address a number of things. New administrative laws that Ms. Streisinger talked about. We talk about best practices. We talk about education. And then on the back, we identify enforcement actions that we've taken since the last. And I think for better or for worse, it's much like when you're driving down the highway and you see an accident, it tends to make you slow down a little bit. When you see one of your colleagues' names on the back of that newsletter, it makes you realize, I need to be sure I'm in compliance so I don't end up in that same situation. So we think that's a useful tool also. Also within our toolbox, as we've indicated, is the opportunity to try and improve the education and the experience level for people coming into the industry. We changed the laws this past year to make sure those people that are going to be acting as loan originators have to have passed an examination, show that they've got minimal qualifications before they start lending. Now, in the past, they had up to 6 months before they had to do that. And so we think this is an important shift. And we've strengthened the test, if you will. We've made sure that we've got an independent testing organization conducting the examination, and the results show that that has been a more challenging test, but we think that's to the benefit of both the public and ultimately to the industry. As I mentioned, one of the other tools in there, of course, is licensing. Now, it's important to understand who we license and who we don't license. We license people who broker loans and also who make loans. We'll call those the mortgage bankers. But that is just a percentage of all those that bank or make the loans. And as you heard earlier, there are national banks and subsidiaries of national banks. And those subsidiaries are many of the large companies that you're most familiar with, whether you see it as an advertisement on television or the radio, or whether you're getting a phone call at dinner time, or whether you're getting something in the mail. Most of those people are the national organizations. Those are not regulated by the states. They are carved out by statute in Oregon. And then recently there was a United States Supreme Court case, Waters versus Wachovia, Wachovia being a national organization, that held very clearly the states could not go in and require a subsidiary of a national bank to get licensed. So there are different licensing mechanisms in place, and that's part of the challenge, I think, for all the states to come up with consistent regulation. Having said that, though, I want to get on to what Senator Westland mentioned, and that is that the enforcement of the current laws is a powerful tool and one that we exercise and take seriously. The first place we start is kind of a hybrid between the education and the enforcement, and that's our examination process. We have the authority to go in and examine both in-state and out-of-state companies that are licensed with us. And this past year, we added two more examiners for that very purpose because we think that's the best course of action. If we can correct a problem, if we can work with the industry to make sure that problems that do not arise to egregious fraud gets changed, then I think everybody wins. And so our first goal is to educate. Of course, if we find violations during the examination process, we then identify those violations, ask for a response, asking them to tell us how they're going to repair those problems or fix those. And then we come back in a relatively short period of time to make sure they've done exactly that. So our examination process, we believe, is helping to bring the industry to a higher level of competence and compliance. So in 2006, we had 105 routine exams. Those are just exams we scheduled. We give advance notice that we're coming in, and then we do a sampling. We also had 19 for cause exams in 2006. Now, for cause exam is when we have gotten a complaint or we have a reason to believe for one reason or another that there are serious problems going on, and we want to go see those for ourselves without asking for just a sampling. We go in and hone right in on what we think is a problem. And oftentimes that may be a situation where an enforcement response may be required if we do find violations. 2007, which obviously we're only less than three-quarters of the way through, we've already had 160 routine exams. Reflects the fact we've added two examiners. We've had 23 for cause exams already. And then we also started doing out-of-state exams because we have so many of the industry out-of-state that it's important we don't just expect the other our sister states to take care of that problem. We also want to examine. So we've examined 38 out-of-state businesses so far. So we think that's an important part of our regulatory efforts to make sure that the industry is in compliance. But, of course, that doesn't address all of it. So the next step is we get complaints, and we get a lot of complaints. Department of Justice gets complaints because it involves lending often. They may not be able to do much with it, but they are a great resource for catching all those complaints. Department of Justice has a more visible name than we do. People are more aware of that. And so we share those complaints on a quarterly basis, and we go through the complaints they get and track that against our list of licensees to make sure if it's somebody that is licensed or somebody we believe should be licensed, we're addressing that complaint. So in 2006, we received 310 complaints. Now, that's a citizen complaint. That could be a complaint from a competitor. Could be something we got from another state. For instance, the state of Idaho sends us information when they take action against somebody who is licensed in both states. So we'll follow that up. But a complaint is just that. It's not a finding that's been a violation. In fact, we're not certain what we've got when we get a complaint. So we will follow that up. We have one individual that works almost full-time on complaints, does occasional for-cause examinations. And the complaints run a broad gambit. You can imagine lately with the market turning that they've become maybe more focused on certain things, particularly loan terms. I see a lot of complaints about loan terms. And the loan terms, by that I mean the fact that some people claim they weren't aware that they were getting into an adjustable rate mortgage rather than a fixed rate, or they didn't understand the amount that the loan could reprice at after the two-year introductory rate, or they didn't understand that there was a prepayment penalty, or they didn't understand that they had signed up for something other than what they got. And that's a situation with the complaint. It's often a he said, she said situation, so it's very challenging for us. We try and work through that on an individual basis between the consumer and the company they're complaining about. Other complaints of note, we've seen a lot of servicing of loans. As you know, many of these national companies contract with a servicing organization to receive the payments and distribute the payments. It's not at all unusual to have somebody make a loan and then sell that loan off, and then that loan gets bundled up, and it gets sold as part of that bundle, and then you have a large national organization that's holding the loans. They don't know what they hold. They rely on the servicer to take care of that. Well, so when there's a problem, the servicer may not be in a position to do much about the problem. So we've got a disconnect between the borrower and the person that ultimately holds the contract. A lot of complaints about servicing. We're starting to see more complaints about the notice of foreclosure, the nature of the notice, or the lack of notice, and frustration over an inability to have the note holder, the mortgage holder, work something out. Well, I don't know where we want to land with that. You know, that's a contractual relationship between the borrower and the lender. It's not the state's position to step in and try and reform that contract. So what we try and do is determine, have there been compliance with all the other aspects? Were the disclosures properly made? Were they notified properly and so forth? So that's what we're looking at rather than trying to reform that. But a lot of frustration out there about the inability to reform their contracts. And then surprisingly, just anecdotally, we get a lot of complaints from appraisers that they're not getting paid by their mortgage brokers. I can't tell you how many we get, but a lot more than I expected to get. So maybe a reflection that some of the industry is having trouble meeting their obligations, or maybe that this is perceived to be a small problem and they're not addressing it. So I said 310 complaints in 2006, 2007, through three quarters of the year, we have had 264 complaints. Complaints then, if they're unresolved or if we feel that there was enough, if you will, probable cause, using a legal term, to justify going forward, will then result in an investigation. In 2006, we had 54 investigations. Through the first 8 months of this year, we've had 24 investigations. And an investigation is obvious to everyone here, I assume, but that takes a lot of time using investigators. We have legal staff members that help us with depositions and so forth, and it's a fairly complex area, and so that takes a lot of time for us. It's not something that we can just go through and take care of in a 30-day period of time necessarily. And then ultimately the investigations, if we find that there's a basis in fact to believe there have been violations, will result in administrative action in most instances. Our enforcement powers are threefold. We can take administrative action, commonly known as a cease and desist order. We can file a civil suit, and we can make a criminal referral. Now, we don't have the authority to actually go forward on the criminal case. That's the purview of a district attorney's office, or in some instances a U.S. attorney's office, if the case is egregious enough and there's enough dollar loss. And we have done both. This year we've made three criminal referrals, and we're working on one from still with the U.S. Attorney's Office as we speak. And then we had two criminal referrals last year. And in most instances, those criminal referrals, once we get a DA's office to commit to that, they will end up in a guilty plea. The difficulty is mortgage lending criminal cases are Class C felony. And a Class C felony, under the fact that this is a white-collar crime, there's a presumption of probation. A lot of the DAs have too many cases to do, and the presumption of probation doesn't make this as an exciting a prospect for them to prosecute. So we see that in many instances, one victim, one target, or if you will, one subject to be prosecuted, probation, DA's office says, I don't think we're going to take that time. So in most instances, it comes back to us doing an administrative action. As I said, our C&Ds in 2006, we took 33 cease and desist orders. To date, in 8 months in 2007, we've done 22 so far. And there are obviously many more pending. A cease and desist order typically results in an order to comply with the law. It may result in a monetary penalty based on the number of violations. And under a consent theory, where we've worked out an agreement, we may on occasion bar a company or bar an individual from engaging in that type of behavior, or in fact out of the industry altogether. We do not have that authority, and that's where I'd like to close. In this business right now, our loan originators, the people that are making the loans, the ones who presumably, if there is fraud, have participated in that fraud, they are subject to registration. We do a criminal history background check. We make sure that they're qualified by an examination. Beyond that, once they're registered, they're good to go as long as they keep up with their continuing education. Now, they can go from company to company and re-register. We don't have the ability under the law currently to ban somebody that is a bad apple. And so we can see somebody move from company to company. Now, if a company checks with us, if they ask if we've got any information, we can provide that, but we don't necessarily have the ability to ban. As I say, we've probably banned about a half a dozen to ten in the past year and a half, but we do that through consent. It would be a very useful tool if we could ban them. But there's a balancing act, and I'll close with this. We currently require the mortgage brokers to
to supervise the loan originators. And that puts them in the, on the hook for the behavior, and that's the way it should be. And in most industries, whether it's real estate or the sale of securities or insurance products, both the company and the individual are both responsible for that individual's behavior. We want to be very careful that we don't create a carte blanche situation where we create responsibility for those individual loan originators and we can band in, but at the same time the mortgage brokers all of a sudden no longer have that supervisory responsibility. Without that, then you're going to have, but right now it's 12,000, but in good times it can be as high as 18,000 individuals out there engaged in their own conduct without an overlay. So with that, I'm going to conclude, and I'm happy to take any questions at this point.
Chair Holby?
Thank you. I think we do have a few minutes for questions from the committee, and maybe I'll start this. I guess one of the underlying issues has been brought forward by the subprime market nationwide, and the alarming increase of foreclosures and what that's doing to the industry and property values out there. And so I'm hearing from you that we do regulate or register and license mortgage lenders and brokers and loan originators as long as they're in the state chartered arena, but we don't when they're affiliated with federally chartered institutions. So I guess my question is, do we have ample laws in place to regulate or enforce mortgage rescue scams? And the second piece away from the mortgage rescue scams, do we have standards that lenders, brokers, loan originators adhere to help prevent inadequate disclosure or underwriting standards that may or may not, well, I'm not saying they should, but underwriting standards that try to prevent foreclosure by making sure people have the ability to pay the loan back, okay, essentially. And is that something that we should be focusing on or not?
Chair Holby and members of both committees, first to the mortgage rescue scams, Mr. Shule probably has some additional information there. There is a statutory scheme for something called credit service organizations, CSOs as they're commonly known, and those are people who will, on behalf of a consumer, work with creditors to try and improve their credit situation. They may do it through education, they may do it through working to remove bad credit reporting and so forth. There's about 10 of them that are licensed with us. We think that the mortgage rescue schemes, at least the first kind that Mr. Ambrose, or the last kind Mr. Ambrose talked about, where somebody says, I can improve your credit history, not dealing with actually giving them money or funding the loan or buying the property with the understanding they'll take it out, but just for the purposes of improving their credit history to try and bump their credit score up to a point where they're no longer subprime, we think the credit service organization law gives us the power to address that. However, I have to tell you, we've had a number of out-of-state companies engaged in this, particularly in the Internet area, who have pushed back and said, that's not what we're doing. We fall outside the purview of that law. And by the way, we think this is unconstitutional that you're trying to restrain us in this way. And so we're meeting a fair amount of resistance there. I think that the proposal that the subcommittee of the governor's working group is going to bring forward will clarify that, and I think that some additional laws as well as some clarification around the credit service organizations would be necessary, and I would strongly encourage these two committees to take a look at taking on some revision and advancements in the mortgage rescue area. Andrew?
Chair Holby, members of the committees, again, I would add to that that there are laws out there, and when these rescue scheme mortgage foreclosure rescue schemes, or even the mortgage foreclosure consultants, which is the second one that has been discussed, if there's fraud involved, if there's misrepresentations involved, if there's non-disclosures involved, these are not loans, these are not extensions of credit, these are not federally chartered operators. it is actionable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Again, that's an enforcement tool. That's something that occurs on the back end, to put it into context, after terrible things have happened. What's being contemplated is a front-end regulatory scheme, and I agree with Mr. Tapman that the concepts that are being put forward seem very useful and very beneficial.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to your second question about the standards that exist currently, particularly across the board, there are a number of standards that apply both to state brokers and to the feds. And the guidelines that Ms. Streisinger referenced earlier are guidelines that already the federal financial enforcement agencies take a look at. FDIC, that is the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation, FRB, Federal Reserve Bank, and the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, OCC. They all have adopted these guidelines, which have the effect of a rule at that level, and you may remember during the discussions of 965, those guidelines were a very hot topic about how they can be implemented here in Oregon and how they're so different given a bank's responsibility versus a mortgage broker's responsibility. But there are those guidelines in place federally. Now, whether the federal agencies are doing a good enough job, an adequate job, I should say, of enforcing that and overseeing that, I'm not in a position to say. Anecdotally, they have so many organizations that they have to look at and so many obligations in terms of safety and soundness that this is at best a small piece of their responsibility. It just intuitively, it seems to me that that's a big piece to take on. And you've heard a lot in Congress trying to address the issue of mortgage lending. It just seems to suggest to me that there is not adequate oversight at that level at this time. But that's just a personal opinion at this point. In addition, there are a number of federal regulations that apply both to the states and the feds, and particularly you've probably heard of Reg Z, Truth in Lending, if you will. And then there's Regulation X. It requires disclosure up front when somebody goes in to get a loan. That form, the HUD 1 form that you get when you come in and ask for a loan, and that you get basic information and the nature of what the interest rate could be and so forth. Obviously, those terms will change from the start to the end, but it's a starting place where some disclosure is made at the outset. Everyone involved at the federal and state level have to do that. So there are some federal oversights. I do think that the states, because of the licensing program and the education piece and our ability to move more quickly and address fraud in the statutes, there's a specific statute that prohibits fraudulent conduct by our licensees, it gives us a lot more latitude and ability to move quickly than I think the feds can. So I think there is a disparity between the federal and the state two oversight programs, if you will. And so, Chairman Holley, I wasn't quite sure what you wanted to hear. Those are the standards, but in terms of the application, they're probably somewhat inconsistent.
Follow-up? Senator Devlin.
Several short questions, actually. In terms of your complaints for 2006 and the first three quarters of 2007, do you issue any kind of reports that basically analyze those complaints or give you any kind of just range of what the complaints are, something that could be provided to the committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we have not done that. We do record them in a database, and there's usually a one- or two-line summary of that, and, in fact, we preserve all of those. I could go back and find out more about that and see if they – I believe what we do is categorize them, and we probably have a subset of 10 categories, maybe more, that they fit within, and we could probably print out a list of the categories that the complaints address.
That might be helpful.
Okay.
If you could give those in terms of percentages. Can you, not here today, but can you provide us some examples of the kinds of terms that have been presented to people in terms of rescue mortgages?
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, yes, we can do that. We have a specific database of complaints along those lines of what we've heard. We hear things anecdotally. I know that Mr. Scholl's organization hears things too. It may be a place where we need to collaborate to give you one document, but we could certainly provide that.
Okay. Third one, Mr. Chairman. Registration or licensure. We've actually, I believe, had proposals before in the legislature to license loan originators. Some of us that have been around and worked both on the policy side and on the budget side with various people that license various professions have had good experiences and bad experiences. What's the merits that you see in licensure, and in licensure, if you were to ban someone from a profession or an occupation, in most cases you'd have to provide some degree of due process, and you'd have to provide, in addition, beyond the normal due process, some degree of appeal or ability to at least reapply to be licensed. Have you given any thought to what the advantages of licensure over registration might be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, we have thought a lot about this. This is an important issue for us. We have talked with the industry, and you're absolutely right. I will say that our entire enforcement scheme around our regulated industries is premised on due process, and, of course, we give them the right notice and right to a hearing, and we will hold a hearing if they want, and the appellate rights, too, and we sometimes go through that entire process. So we recognize that. We think that's the appropriate way to handle such a situation. In many instances, as I mentioned earlier, if it's egregious enough, someone will realize they're caught, just like in a criminal case, and they'll end up admitting their wrongdoing and agree to a ban. The real challenging interest for me is, or real challenging issue for me is, how long should the ban be? Should it be a lifetime ban? Should it be a three-year ban? I certainly can't see anything less than a three-year ban, and it's probably somewhere in between. So that's the challenging issue. Do you believe in reformation? In some instances, people can be reformed. Some instances, I think people lose the right to come back into the industry. The big challenge for us in licensing is that creates a whole new subset of people that we're responsible for overseeing on a much broader level. And as I said, 12,000 to 15,000 loan originators, if we have to go in and examine each of them or make sure they're doing their job properly, it presents a big challenge. Frankly, it would mean we would have to substantially increase the size of our staffing to go out and do that. At a time when the industry is shrinking and maybe profit margins are reducing, that's a challenge in itself. That's why my big goal is to make sure whatever happens, and my preference at this point would be registration, but registration that allows for the banning of the individuals. But the bottom line goal for me is to make sure that the mortgage broker, the person who holds a license, continues to have that oversight responsibility. Without that, we've divorced the one from the other, and these people are now free agents and they're going to cause potential havoc.
Final question. In terms of disclosure, I've had several experiences in my life where I've had to sign numerous forms in disclosure. One of them was entering the Marine Corps.
Should have read that one twice.
Yeah, it didn't say sign your rights and life away and et cetera. But buying a home, purchasing a new car. In buying a home, you're getting a new mortgage. How many of these items are individually disclosed, or where the consumer has to make a conscious choice, not a choice, but in the sense of knows, for instance, obviously, did they sign a specific disclosure on what the prepayment penalty was? Did they sign a specific disclosure on what the maximum APR could be on an ARM? What do we know in terms of, are those disclosures specific for the consumer, or are they basically signing off on the entire document?
Co-chairs and Senator Devlin, it is the latter for the most part. Some states have adopted that. What they've adopted is a very specific form, much like the truth in lending, which you specifically acknowledge this is what prepayment penalty is, this is what your adjustable rate is, this is when it can reset and all that. It's a one-pager in large, bold type. The criticism I've heard is this is just one more form that they have to sign at the time of closing, and when you're signing multiple forms at the time of closing, you somewhat just say, yeah, it's one more thing, I'm signing it, and they don't pay any more attention to it. I think there's merit in what you say, though, because I think those are the crossroad points in the agreement that people tend not to recognize when they're excited about buying a house. So I have two minds in that area. I think anything we can do to make consumers aware of what they're actually getting into is a good thing to do. I think you're going to hear from members of the industry that a lot of people are resistant to more disclosure instead of more enforcement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nice to see you here.
Question? Yes, thank you. Mr. Chapman, I just a point of information. You talked about the restrictions you have to banning, and then you referred to banning by consent, and I think that was part of your answer to one of Senator Devlin's questions. Would you just expand on that and explain what you mean by banning by consent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, what that situation is when we get to the point where we're engaged in enforcement and we've concluded our investigation and it's apparent to us that we've got somebody that's in violation of the law, many times what we'll say is we have two directions we can take this in. We can go and issue a notice hearing, which is essentially that right to a hearing to ask us to go through the proof of the facts that we believe have occurred and establish that those facts resulted in certain conclusions of law or violations of law, actually, and then the imposition of the penalty is appropriate. And that will go to a hearings officer. In most instances, that means someone has to hire an attorney. And, of course, we're represented by an attorney, sometimes the Department of Justice, sometimes somebody within our staff. And then it can go on to the appellate process and so forth. It's a very long and involved process. In some instances, people will say, I would rather just settle this right now because I recognize I've done wrong. And, you know, this wasn't working out for me. I'm happy to step out, and I'll trade a ban for 3 to 5 years in lieu of maybe an imposition of a $25,000, $30,000 penalty. And we may say, fine, here's what we'll do. We'll impose that penalty, but we'll suspend it so long as you remain consistent with that ban and stay out of the industry. So it's basically a settled agreement between the two parties, and this is something that both parties think is in the best interest of both the consumer and, in this case, the individual too.
Kind of follow up, Mr. Chair.
You go ahead.
Thank you. Quickly. In 2006, how many times did that come to bear on the cases that you had referred to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I don't have the exact number. I was just going through counting them. I would say it was less than half a dozen times.
Thank you.
But I do think that was a good question in terms of the frequency. Also, I was taken by not a curious statement, but when you indicated that there are appraisers servicing the industry that weren't paid. And of course, I mean, people get behind in their bills, and business has been tough for mortgage brokers and loan originators here in the last couple, 3-4 months. But I just wonder, as kind of a canary in the coal mine type of thing, if there isn't some indice we can't pull out of that in terms of unscrupulous, unsavory types associating themselves with a given industry, you know, to make the quick buck and then just be gone.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you, and that's one of the things we do. We take those seriously, and every one of those complaints, even though that's kind of a business-to-business problem and it doesn't really impact us, it's a reflection that maybe somebody's not running their business right, and our man on the ground there, he contacts every one of those mortgage brokers to find out what the problem is and have an explanation as to why they haven't been paid. It almost drives us into that collection agency business because inevitably that results in the guy getting paid, but it also is a sign that is there something more we need to be aware of?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I don't know how you get your arms around that, but I do think it's, like I say, some type of industry. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's move on. Let's get to the stakeholder perspective of this. We're actually right on time, and we will hear everybody that's on the agenda. So I do appreciate all being in attendance, and let's begin with Pam Levitt and Paul Kirkbride, here from our friends at the credit unions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I'm here with Paul Kirkbride, who's an actual expert in this area for us. He's with United Community Credit Union. Thank you all for having this hearing, pulling us all together. Thank you, Teresa, for doing such a great job. I do want to make a few things clear with you. I want to talk quickly about regulation, and then you really want to hear about what we're seeing, and that's where Paul's going to take it over. And I did include a fairly thick packet. I apologize, but there's some important information in there. First of all, the federal regulations that were previously referred to that financial institutions already comply with, Regulation Z, which is also called Truth in Lending, RESPA, other federal regulations, these regulations, both state and federally chartered credit unions have to comply with, because all federally insured credit unions are under these regulations. So I want to make it clear that state chartered credit unions in Oregon, we have about 85 credit unions, 30 of them are state chartered. They do have to comply with these federal regulations because they are federally insured. So I don't want you to think that some of these regulations that state charters don't have to comply with. And I just gave you a little bit of background about Regulation Z and RESPA. We have both state and federal regulators in credit union offices every 12 to 18 months. I brought our director of compliance, whose full-time job is to help our credit unions comply with state and federal regulations, and she says they're very clear about going in and reviewing their mortgage portfolios. The other thing I wanted to talk about, which Mr. Tapman referred to, is the interagency statement on subprime mortgage lending. I attached a copy of it in my testimony. In there, it came out from Department of Treasury, the Fed, FDIC, NCUA is our federal regulator, National Credit Union Administration. From what we're hearing, even though it is a statement on subprime lending guidelines, our federal regulators are considering this the same as a rule, a new rule. These guidelines will be reviewed by examiners and made sure that our credit unions are complying with these guidelines. So I included that in my packet so that you can see what both state and federally chartered credit unions are conforming with on subprime lending. You didn't want to listen to me talk about regulation, so I want to have you listen to Paul, who's going to talk about what he's seen at the credit union level.
Pam? Excuse me. United States has been making mortgage loans and servicing mortgage loans for nearly 30 years.
Introduce yourself first.
I apologize. Mm-hmm. My name is Paul Kirkbride with United States Community Credit Union. As I stated, we've been making mortgage loans for nearly 30 years. Historically speaking, credit unions are known for their ability to restructure borrowers' current obligations, making their overall monthly loan payments more affordable. We can do this through a combination of competitive interest rates, lower fees, and flexible loan programs, which does make us the ideal outlet for borrowers who are having problems. However, during the past year, we have not seen a significant increase in the number of applicants seeking to escape from non-traditional mortgage products. And although we have not seen a rise in those types of applications, we have seen a significant increase in our overall loan volume, our mortgage loan volume. We attribute this to savvy consumers taking advantage of today's low fixed rates. They're still historically low, and we see numerous consumers moving out of the adjustable rate products into the fixed rate products. We have not seen the potentially negative consequences associated with subprime lending in our market as of today. In addition, overall mortgage loan volume, many other credit unions across the nation remains vibrant and strong. It is important to point out that one of the key advantages of subprime lending is its ability to increase home ownership in our communities. Without subprime lending, many worthy borrowers would simply not qualify for their first home loan. And although a subprime loan is inherently of higher risk, if priced and structured appropriately, both the borrower and the lender can benefit from that program. To increase home ownership across the country, our industry trade group, the Credit Union Association, Credit Union National Association, suggested in October 2005 that credit unions adopt the Home Loan Payment Relief Program, which offers first-time home buyers a below-market interest rate and reduced private mortgage insurance costs. This program is geared to those who make 100% or less of an area's median income. Commonly referred to as the Helper Loan, credit unions across the nation, including Unitas, agreed to offer this loan program to their membership, further demonstrating our commitment to the core purpose of credit unions, which is helping those that are underserved. Nationally, credit unions have committed over $1.3 billion to this program. Members qualifying for this program can save hundreds of dollars in the monthly loan payment when compared to a traditional subprime loan, making the dream of home ownership a reality. To date, our credit unions made nearly $6 million in helper loans, and we have committed to making at least $10 million. Thank you, co-chairs and committee. That concludes it.
We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I think we want to hold them because we want to make sure we've got... Paul, I just want to echo...
Make sure your cell phones are on.
We forgot that in the introductory instructions, so you're off the hook this time. However,
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, we're laying that at Gilliam's feet. We think that's Gilliam's fault.
It was an echo.
On a serious note, you used a phrase which I agree with regard to subprime, and it's if priced and structured appropriately. And like any product, there can be room for improvement. There can be, it can be good as it is, or it can be, you know, sold or abused if priced and structured appropriately.
Chair Westland, I agree with you.
Yeah, I think most people in the room do. Anyway, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Linda Navarro, our banker lady. We're so glad that Tim Martinez is not coming forward. Thank you. I hope he's in the room.
Yes.
He is.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
he's got his laptop on. He's taking every note.
Please proceed. Enter and sign in, please.
Chair Westland and members of the committee, I'm Linda Navarro, and I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and I do appreciate the opportunity to be here today and participate in this hearing. The industry I represent includes 54 state and national banks and savings banks doing business in the state of Oregon, and that includes every bank that is currently supervised as a state chartered bank by the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. As we know, the mortgage lending industry is comprised of different types of lenders, and we've heard about some of those. Ours amount to the depository institutions that are highly regulated and supervised by federal and state agencies and are examined as such. And as Mr. Tatman pointed out, that's both on a regular schedule and for cause. On the point of regulation, I do want to, I think, differ from Mr. Tatman on one point, and that is that I do believe that the federal regulations and the federal regulators are very effective in this area. And, in fact, even today, Treasury Secretary Paulson spoke on this very issue at Georgetown University. Across the nation and here in Oregon, as we know, much has been written about mortgage lending, subprime, predatory lending, and the mortgage markets. And while some is quite accurate, some is far less so. And without getting into any kind of difference of opinion on statistics, I do think it's important for us to look at a few probably agreeable statistics on the national level to understand the problems dimensions nationally, which is really what has driven the discussion in a lot of states, including our own. In Oregon, we do believe that we are in a better position according to data, and I think you have a few slides that I distributed to you than the rest of the nation, at least in right now and in certain areas. For example, in foreclosure inventory, the data that we rely on shows us 50 out of 51 right now. And I'm not suggesting that that won't change or can't change, and there's a reset schedule in there to help you understand when people talk about pending resets of adjustable rate mortgages. But generally speaking, we believe we're in pretty good shape in Oregon, we should look at the situation based on these facts rather than rhetoric and make sure that we continue to have viable options for consumers looking to purchase a home. But specifically looking at the national data, first of all, I'd like to point out that 35% of American homeowners own their home free and clear. And of those with mortgages, 94% are currently paying on time, which is good news. But we do know that the problem lies with the subprime market, and that is about 14% of the total market. And presently, only about 85% of subprime borrowers are paying on time. With the resetting, as I mentioned, of adjustable rate mortgages, this may continue to cause some delinquencies, and that is not such good news. But it does reveal something important, and that is that the majority of subprime loans are performing, and that suggests that most subprime borrowers are in a good loan that they are capable of repaying. A subprime loan does not necessarily equate to a bad loan or predatory loan if, as we've heard, it's in the right situation and it's carefully thought out and the terms are suitable to the home buyer. As for the health of banks in the face of the mortgage market turmoil, I'd like to point out that insured banks and savings institutions are very sound today and will be able to weather the economic downturn. And as I said before, nationally 94% of mortgage borrowers are paying their loans on time, and Oregon banks are among the healthiest in the nation by just about every standard you can measure against. Banks are in a unique position, I think, to help in this crisis with helping borrowers understand the options available to them. We encourage borrowers from day one to communicate with their lender before they actually start missing payments, just to communicate at which point they are believing they won't be able to make their next payment. And at that point, lenders are in the position of being able to work out with borrowers situations where they can make flexible payment plans, extend mortgage payment terms, and in some cases refinance that borrower into a suitable mortgage product. We can't help in every case with every consumer that's obtained a loan from another lender, but banks are in a unique position to be able to continue to do that today. But this all does lead to the subject of foreclosures that we've heard about, and I'd like to point out that generally, we're talking about the most exotic loan products that are leading to the increase in foreclosures, and the market itself has dried up the those exotic loan products, which I'll also point out generally have not been made by Oregon banks. We can't really find situations with Oregon banks, particularly those supervised by the state of Oregon, that issue any of these types of products. But that said, we think the market has corrected and done away with most of these risky loans. And I'd also like to point out that a lot of these risky loans are actually on investor-owned properties as well, people who speculated in the market. But looking at borrowers that are at risk of foreclosure on their primary residence, I believe that that's where our attention should be focused. Education is key, and assisting borrowers in a time when they might be facing foreclosure is, I think, a very important work of this committee. Particularly, we've heard about these mortgage rescue schemes, and I myself am just beginning to understand what these are. And I've talked to a number of our members, and in fact, we're having someone come into a committee meeting next month to explain what these are. Most of our member banks aren't really even familiar with the mortgage rescue scheme. So we believe, based on what we've learned thus far, that there could be potentially be some serious problems there, and we would support looking at some parameters around what would be acceptable practices, much like the parameters that are around financial institutions today. So in closing, Oregon's highly regulated commercial banks and savings banks have generally stayed away from most of these risky types of loan products, and they're solid financial institutions that adhere to the fundamentals of safety and soundness, sound underwriting standards, due diligence, and capital standards, and very important, I believe, is that they are interested in healthy long-term relationships with their customers. Though the loan portfolios of banks in Oregon are mostly unaffected by the current subprime mortgage problem, federally insured banks and savings institutions are able and willing to be part of the subprime solution. They are well capitalized and have a diverse source of funds, including deposits and Federal Home Loan Bank advances. They are in a solid position to keep mortgage dollars flowing to creditworthy borrowers and communities, and in doing so, prevent today's market turmoil from becoming a housing crisis. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We'll hold questions till the end. But Linda, thank you.
Thank you.
Very good testimony. Janet. Enter and sign in, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Westland, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the 19,000-plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I will apologize in advance to all of you for my cold today. I hope my written testimony perhaps makes more sense than my public testimony. But in any event, I want to thank you for your efforts on behalf of looking at this issue, because certainly representing the realtors, maintaining a strong and vibrant real estate market in Oregon is our goal, and certainly we would hope is yours as well. Oregon's homeownership rates have consistently lagged behind the national average, and we'd be caution you to be careful in whatever attempts you do that it wouldn't adversely affect the opportunity to own homes in Oregon. And certainly there are also a number of reasons that move people into foreclosure other than loan products, so we should keep that in the back of our mind. But when the subject came up, I started looking on our website with the National Association of Realtors to see what kind of information I could find. And the issue of mortgage rescue schemes was starting to get some attention at the national level. And there was some information provided to our members to warn them about a variety of schemes, and they seem to fall into sort of three basic categories, and I thought I would just take a brief moment and describe those to you today. And the first is what they call the lease buyback scheme, and here's where the rescuer states that they'll save an individual's house from foreclosure, they'll pay off their credit cards, their other debts, and that homeowner must sort of temporarily sign over their home to them while they help them get back on track. And, of course, that temporary condition is false. As soon as they sign over this their deed, they rent the house back. The new owner increases the rent and evicts the owner and has possession of the house. The second is what we call, NAR is calling the bait and switch. Here's where the homeowner is supposedly assigning documents, new loan documents, to refinance their mortgage, but instead of refinancing, they found out that what they've signed are deed transfers and the homeowner's lost the property. And the third is one I think that was touched on a little bit earlier. It's called what NAR is referring to as phantom help. And here's where a rescuer holds themselves out as a rescue specialist. They're, you know, able to negotiate with the bank to help them refinance their loan. And the rescuer charges fees up front. They may do nothing. They may make a couple of phone calls. But in the end of it, the homeowner now finds themselves out the cost of these fees and still in a state of foreclosure. So a number of states, we're starting to see that there are a number of states have enacted legislation to protect homeowners facing foreclosures from some of these practices. And the one I brought to your attention in my testimony today is the Illinois Mortgage Fraud Rescue Act. And I think the pertinent point in it is it requires a written notice disclosure specifying all of the services that rescuers will provide and the effects of these actions, such as signing over a deed. In fact, in the statute, it requires plain English, such as part of this transaction, you're giving up title to your home, so that it's clear and understandable to the folks engaging in this what the cost of this assistance is. In addition to that, the Illinois provision states that payment due to rescuers is due only after all the services have been provided. And that particular their particular statute creates a very liberal right to cancellation of services. When we took a look at this, we thought it may be more appropriate, if you choose to go this direction, to look at creating a more objective right of rescission similar to that found in real estate contracts of 5 business days. But certainly, in addition to any kind of legislative or regulatory reform, homeowners would benefit from additional efforts on the by the state to help create opportunities to educate them when these problems arise. And this is the kind of opportunity that you all could partner with those of us in industry to help you provide to consumers, and we would be willing to participate in that. And so with that, I thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Dana, thank you very much. And you did very well.
Thank you.
And be well.
Thank you.
Angela Martin, and do you have anyone you wish to bring with you to the dais?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for asking, but I do have Hello again, Chair Holby. I'm going to back up and say what I should have said before, and that's thank you very much for having this conversation today.
Can you back up a little further and state your name?
I can. Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon, which, as you may know, is a statewide nonprofit working on issues of tax and economic fairness. And it seems that illness is taking many people down. Next to me today was going to be Paul Leonard from Center for Responsible Lending, and he couldn't even call me to back out yesterday because he has laryngitis. So he had someone else call me to tell me that he was not getting on the plane. I did, however, bring his testimony, all 18 pages of it, and make that available for you. I'm here today to express our strong support for policies aimed at protecting home ownership through fair lending laws. The headlines carry the news of foreclosures across the country, and those headlines have been constant and consistent. Since we've last discussed these issues, end of last session, Wall Street, federal regulators, and the media have been in a literal frenzy as the subprime mortgage market has imploded. I opened my email box today, and the first email from my news clipping service was another front page headline from New York Times business pages talking about how the performance of subprime loans in 2007 is worse than the performance of subprime loans in the two previous years, meaning that we are going into foreclosure faster for this most recent crop of loans. Recently, the most recently released Mortgage Banker Association data revealed that second quarter foreclosure rates have reached the highest level in the history of the survey. And as expected, and as we've heard, foreclosures in the subprime market are the most severe. On page 16 of the Center for Responsible Lending testimony, which is coming around, you are provided with a chart listing historical performance of subprime loans here in Oregon. This uses MBA data to look at, again, the question of how have subprime loans performed, how many foreclosures have we seen. The chart shows that while in the first quarter of 2003, subprime loans made up just 3% of the total loan market here in Oregon, they represented 18% of foreclosures in the Oregon market. Fast forward to the second quarter of 2007, we find that subprime loans make up 12% of outstanding loans here in Oregon and a stunning 65% of foreclosures. Again, in the second quarter of 2007. The worst news has yet to arrive for the thousands of Oregon homeowners who will face monthly payment increases ranging from $400 to $1,000 when they see their adjustable rate mortgage leave the introductory period. Just yesterday, we received some information we've all been waiting for, and those were a set of data from First American CoreLogic showing how many homeowners between now in November 2008, we'll be seeing such a giant payment shock. We look at the number and see that 15,000 Oregon homeowners can expect to see significant payment increases, again, between now and about November 2008.
Can you give me a percent significant payment, I mean a 20%?
First American CoreLogic estimates a low range of 29%. Estimates go up, and there was in today's New York Times business page, they quote figures as high as 40%. So 29% monthly payment increase. In the dollar figure, the $400 that I estimate, again, comes from the First American CoreLogic estimates. There's good news in this, though. You have to have some good news. And the good news is I believe that a workable solution exists. I also must agree with Linda Navarro that the financial community can and must be part of the solution. However, I first want to look a little bit more at how we got into this mess and what we can do to minimize the damage to families. As I've said before, proliferation of subprime lending by less than scrupulous lenders is setting families back and causes serious consequences for local communities and our state as a whole. Within the last decade, we've heard that subprime lending has grown from a small niche market to a significant share of the current mortgage market. There's also been a rise in the number of non-traditional loans. Oregon ranks as one of the top states for two types of non-traditional loans, which carry high risks of foreclosure. That's the interest-only mortgages and negative amortizing mortgages. We find that in 2005, a full third of Oregon mortgages were interest-only, and after the first quarter of 2006, 9.4% of Oregon mortgages were negatively amortizing, meaning that every month someone makes that minimum monthly payment, the amount they owe on their home actually increases. Skyrocketing home prices in Oregon made many families wonder if they could ever afford to own a home. And joining me in the audience today are two such people, Bob and Marty Barney. They, like many others, didn't believe they could attain home ownership. Opened up the paper back in the end of last year, December 2007, and found a home ownership class that was being offered. They attended the class and listened to everything that the loan officer and the real estate agent had to teach them and caught the excitement and the bug of we could become homeowners too. They sat down with the loan officer and explained their financial circumstances. They're approaching retirement. They're on what they understand to be fixed income. Social Security isn't going to go up anytime soon. And they understood that they could afford about $1,000 per month. And this is the scenario that they put out to their lender. They put their small life savings on the line, putting down $15,000 down payment for their home. They walked into this admitting that they felt naive, which is why they took the class. What they ended up with was a negative amortizing payment option loan. They believed that they were getting a mortgage with a $1,000 monthly payment. In reality, that was the minimum payment, and every time they only paid $1,000, they ended up owing an additional $1,400 on the back end, meaning that with every payment, their house payment grows. They're sitting there today looking at what their options are, and like many people in Oregon, might be lucky enough to cash in on the increasing home values and sell their home through a distressed sale. The result will be they're without their first home. That was to be the home they wanted to live in, like they told the loan officer, until they died. That's not going to be the case. They may escape, but they're not escaping with all the money that they had put down to begin with. So what's contributing to these scenarios? Risky loans. Fair and responsible lending practices entail making a good faith assessment of the loan product that matches the borrower's current financial status. Again, I look to Bob and Marty. They made it very clear that they were not in a home to be investors or to flip it or to sell it in 2 years. They were there to stay. The product that they were offered did not match their requests. Loose underwriting. Underwriting is a process of determining risk based on an evaluation of the value of the property and the ability of the borrower to repay that loan. Or underwriting that does not include verification of income, excludes the cost of property taxes and insurance, and fails to assess the borrower's ability to pay after the initial teaser rate puts the borrowers at serious risk of foreclosure. And then broker abuses. Again, I look to Bob and Martin, who summed it up best when they explained that they just placed their faith in two people that they thought were representing their best interest. Well, in Oregon, that's not the case. There is no requirement that the person making you the loan has to have your best financial interest at heart. As we've also heard today, the debate regarding risk in foreclosure in the mortgage market is full of numbers and statistics. When considering foreclosure rates, the most commonly reported statistics are based on quarterly reports published by the MBA and RealtyTrack. These reports reflect the percentage of total loans that are in foreclosure at a specific point in time. The pool of loans include loans that were originated decades ago, and they're nearing that very magical point of being almost paid off. That pool of loans also includes loans that was just taken out, perhaps last year. Another method for measuring loan performance is to track a group of loans or a loan cohort over time. Mortgage lenders, investors, insurers, and rating agencies measure the performance of a loan cohort in order to predict risk and profitability. This type of analysis is a very useful way to measure lifetime foreclosure rates on particular types of loans. As I was drafting my testimony last night, I needed an analogy that helps me understand sometimes very complex facts and figures that we're looking at. And the analogy that made most sense to me is the two ways that we could look at high school dropout statistics. Taking the point-in-time approach, we would ask the question, how many students dropped out of high school in the second semester of 2005? And that would give us a very useful number. Using the cohort approach, we would ask the question, how many freshmen entering high school in 2005 eventually made it to the graduation day? A different number tells us a different situation, and that's the two ways that we can look at measuring foreclosures in Oregon and nationally. I use that example and take it to the specific data that CRL is going to provide or has provided for us. In December 2006, they produced a report using the cohort approach or the cumulative analysis to ask the question, how are subprime loans performing now and into the future? On page 3 of my testimony, I provide a chart that shows you that their projections are in line with the projections offered by many reputable sources, including First American Real Estate Solutions, Lehman Brothers, and Moody's.com. All of their total number of projected foreclosures are right in line. There is one difference. MBA has a much lower estimate of foreclosures than the four other organizations I list. So what did CRL find for Oregon? Looking at the group of loans originated in 2006, they find that foreclosure rates, projected foreclosure rates, reaching 19.6% of all subprime loans that were taken out in 2006. And I won't go through the numbers, they're there before you, but you can see that they were provided for the major metropolitan areas across our state. I certainly believe that alone, those numbers alone, are cause for action. But what those numbers do not capture is the number of families who are escaping foreclosure through distressed sale. Again, I point to the couple who've joined me here today. So we have to look at solutions that are going to be aimed towards sustainable home ownership. Nearly 60% of a family's total wealth in the middle class resides in their home equity. So what can we do to help protect that very important family wealth? First, require lenders to consider their customers' ability to pay the true cost of the loan. 27 states have some underwriting standards. Oregon does not. Limit excessive prepayment penalties. 29 states limit prepayment penalties. 11 states ban them altogether. Oregon does not. Prevent lenders from refinancing existing home loans when it does not result in a tangible net benefit to the borrower. 20 states ban loan flipping. Oregon does not. Prohibit steering. Borrowers deserve the best terms for which they qualify. 1 in 5 subprime borrowers have credit scores that warrant lower loan costs. Again, I look over my shoulder to the couple who joined me today, and every lender they approached after finding themselves in a mess indicate that they could have qualified for a better loan. They ended up with a 9.75% loan when it looks like their credit score supported a 7% or 7.5% loan. So prohibiting that steering. I'm going to end by, again, thanking you for the time that you've given me here today and being able to participate in what I know is an ongoing discussion. I urge you to act sooner rather than later so that we can help meet the crisis for the families who are looking at immediate payment increases. Thank you very much.
Angela, thank you. Laura?
Is that your cell phone?
No, I don't have to answer.
we want you to know, Laura, we have arranged this, you know, particular distraction because just for you.
Thank you. Here's Wesleyan and Holby, members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. And
excuse me, Laura, could you get on the jackhammer? I had this all timed out.
And I want to thank you for the
downstairs. It won't stop anytime soon.
For the accompaniment today. I think we've all, become aware over the last year or so, and increasingly in the last couple months, that problematic lending practices, particularly in the subprime market, are creating a big problem for more than just the people who are stuck in those loans. We're all reading about the hardship that this is bringing on families, increasing foreclosures across the country, but we're also seeing broader impacts. These increased foreclosures are creating sort of a fertile ground for mortgage rescue schemes for families facing foreclosure. They weaken whole neighborhoods. They have made prices in the mortgage-backed securities market collapse. They're impacting, they can impact property values and even international credit markets. So this is a serious problem. It has it's grown to such a degree that its effects are rippling out far larger than I think anyone anticipated. In terms of the problem in Oregon, according to the Realty Track data released last week, as reported by the Associated Press, Oregon's foreclosure rates are at about 50% higher than they were at this time last year for September. And Oregon overall is in about the middle of the pack, according to that report. I want to urge Oregon to look both at how to help families who are facing these problems right now and how to prevent them from being further victimized by mortgage rescue schemes that get them in even worse trouble, but also to take a look at how what practices got us in this mess in the first place, rein in those damaging practices so that we actually end up preventing an even bigger problem down the road, and ideally make home ownership and buying a home in Oregon something that is more fair and more attainable for Oregonians, and in fact will make us stronger in the long term. I think we have that opportunity now. I think we have that responsibility right now, and should proceed with that. I want to highlight a couple of elements that have combined to contribute to the crisis, and I think it is it's more than just the fact that there's a subprime market. That's not the problem. It's specific lending practices within that market that we've seen, and the combination of them joining forces to create sort of a perfect bad storm. First, as you've heard, borrowers are paying higher rates than they qualify for, and this problem is partly driven and exacerbated by what I really think can only be called kickbacks that brokers receive from lenders for steering borrowers into a loan of a higher rate than the one they qualify for. That's something that I don't think any borrower goes in to purchase their first home, their second home, whatever it is, thinking that they actually are being told that they need to get a loan that is higher than they would qualify for. But the reality is we're seeing this with alarming frequency. Once a borrower is in a loan that is higher than one that they should be paying for, is just a very high fee or a high rate, we're seeing abusive prepayment penalties. Now, not all prepayment penalties are bad, but ones that extend for 3 years into the loan and that are of such a high degree that homeowners really become trapped in a loan of a very high rate. So some of these prepayment penalties can be as much as 6 months' worth of interest on the loan. It can be $10,000, and borrowers, homeowners, are really stuck in these loans. And finally, this all comes to a head when we're seeing the exploding adjustable rate mortgages sort of
come due. So borrowers are qualifying for loans with a very initial low teaser rate, and those are the rate that the broker or loan originator is actually qualifying the lender based on, is that low rate. Then after 2 or 5 years, the rate goes way up. And again, that rate is going up higher than you would want it to, because they should have qualified for a better rate, but we're seeing them having a higher rate. They're stuck in that loan because of the prepayment penalties. In theory, they may be able to refinance. The appreciation on their house has gone up so much that they may be able to sell the house and get out of the deal. It's not exactly the dream of home ownership than anyone imagined. And, frankly, in a situation with very high prepayment penalties and with a flat or even decreasing housing market, it's just not possible for families. I think that critically sort of surrounding all of that is a failure of a good assessment of the borrower to really repay the loan, especially at that fully indexed rate as the adjustable rate mortgage resets. And then, of course, the inclusion of some of the more non-traditional or exotic loan products, such as negative amortization, which makes it pretty impossible for a homeowner to actually build equity, but actually they end up increasing their debt. To protect consumers and the stability of Oregon's communities and protect really the concept of home ownership in Oregon, we would echo other recommendations that I believe you've heard to protect communities. Brokers and lenders must make sure a loan or a refinancing agreement is actually in the interest of the borrower, including the best rate that the borrower qualifies for and that the loan is suitable for the borrower. We should limit excessive fees, which are not reflected in the rates, but which are financed and increases the cost of the loan. Lenders should be honest with borrowers about what they can afford, qualify borrowers based on the fully indexed rate of the loan, not the teaser rate. I believe there are many borrowers and brokers who do these practices, and really we want to set the standard at what the best practice is in Oregon. These reforms should be a priority to enact now. I think we've got an opportunity to make owning a home more possible in Oregon and a more fair experience for everyone. Thank you.
You've got another minute and 15 seconds.
Time for questions.
No, I don't want to get that started. But hang around, because we will have questions later. Thank you very much. Chris Ambrose and Mr. Temple.
Good morning, Chairman Holby and Chairman Westland, members of the committees. Again, my name is Christopher Ambrose. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association today. To my left is Jim Temple of Home Street Bank, who is the legislative chair this year of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Thank you for the opportunity. You have had the opportunity today to hear a number of different perspectives, and we certainly hope that we can provide a little insight, at least from our perspective. The Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association is the Oregon affiliate, as I mentioned earlier, of the National Mortgage Bankers Association. It has approximately 140 members covering a broad spectrum of lenders, ranging from national banks to local financial institutions. The OMLA believes it is critical that the interim legislation and future legislation not take action that is going to put Oregon at a competitive disadvantage with the rest of the country, or that otherwise will hinder an already teetering housing market. One of the questions that I've been asked to address today is whether there actually is a problem resulting from the national lending crisis in Oregon, and certainly, of course, there is. As with a lot of situations, however, there are numerous differences of opinion, suffice it to say, regarding the nature and extent of the problem and what should be done to address it. Yes, Oregon has been affected. Foreclosures in the state of Oregon are, depending on what statistics you listen to, are certainly up anywhere from 50 to 100% from a year ago. ARMs in Oregon, like the rest of the country, will continue to reset at a higher than normal rates.
The question then is what to do about it. You've heard lots of statistics again, and you'll be hearing more statistics from the data subcommittee about the problems in the state of Oregon. We believe it's important, however, to separate the wheat from the chaff. Home ownership is indisputably at record highs in this country. The Oregon mortgage lenders and mortgage lenders across the country take great pride in the role that they have played in increasing the home ownership in this country. Of course, as a result of that, many of the homeowners were put into homes or loans that they should not have been put into in the first place. However, Oregon's foreclosure rates are at an average for the country. The delinquency rate in Oregon, as by MBA statistics as of Q2, are 50th nationally. The serious delinquencies across the board, FHA loans, subprime loans, are anywhere from 48th or 49th across the in Oregon compared to the rest of the country. Does this suggest there are problems that do not, or there are not problems that need to be addressed? Certainly not. However, in responding to a couple of the comments earlier today, there is legislation that has been put in place around the country, and that should be our best indicator or most reliable indicator on what we possibly can do in the state of Oregon. Oregon put into place dramatic predatory lending legislation. Illinois did. The Oakland area did. Ohio, Indiana, Michigan are all in the process of expanding on their predatory lending legislation. In each instance, particularly Oregon, Illinois, the Oakland area, they were unmitigated disasters. Simply standing up here and informing you or giving you some indication that a certain number of states have predatory lending legislation in place does not solve the problem without analyzing whether or not that legislation in those particular states did anything to help the home ownership in those states or to decrease the number of subprime loans that ultimately went into default. Again, from our perspective, from the OMLA perspective, this is a national crisis that requires national solutions, not simply looking at what can be done in Oregon that is going to dramatically affect home ownership or the lending institutions in Oregon. Some of the problems or some of the issues, proposals rather, seem less are less obvious than others. Here are some of the things that are being done, at least what the MBA and OMLA are proposing at the national level. New tools for federal housing, for the Federal Housing Administration to reach more low and moderate income borrowers, including a zero down payment option and risk-based pricing. More effective consumer disclosures, including a simplified and more meaningful standard good faith estimate and HUD-1 form, also known as the 1003, which is the initial application. These are national forms that are required for virtually every loan, not just in the state of Oregon. A national standard to more effectively and consistently combat predatory lending. Tax incentives for home ownership, affordable rental, housing, and community development, including preservation of the mortgage interest deduction. Continue to work with locally the DCBS to modify and systemize the licensing and regulation of mortgage originators in the state of Oregon. Support the Department of Housing and Urban Development in setting and governing standards for the government services enterprises. Reintroduce and quick passage of legislation that will provide a strong and effective regulatory oversight of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the federal home loan banks. Continue to support the creation of a single and stronger
We'll get to Jack.
GSEs. Sorry. Advocate for legislation to relieve FHA from overly burdensome processes and restrictions. Simplifying the RESPA reform. Again, these are all federal measures that are going to ultimately affect the housing market in the state of Oregon and that are already required for virtually every loan in the state of Oregon involving a 1-4 single residential unit. The MBA has sought $6.25 million in dedicated funding for 30 new federal Bureau of Investigation field investigators. OMLA and MBA will continue to support federal legislation that would modify and assist with implementation of the Graham-Leach-Liley privacy bills. What can we do in the state of Oregon that is not inconsistent with the federal measures that are already in the works? One is the slight modification of the foreclosure laws. One of the items that I failed to mention earlier with respect to the Mortgage Rescue Subcommittee is that it also is addressing the foreclosure laws in the state of Oregon. As part of that, there has been some consensus. It appears that some measures could be taken to assist with that process. For example, expanding the notice, providing notices of where to go for assistance similar to a summons in a civil complaint situation, assist with obtaining payoff information. Secondly, expanding the opportunities for education. It is not in the best interest of either the lenders or the borrowers, as Mr. Temple will testify, to have any loan go into foreclosure on the residential front.
Chris, so we can get to Mr. Temple.
Yes, I'm sorry. My apologies. A public awareness campaign, both at the back end and the front end, and continued enforcement, first and foremost, of the laws that are already in place. The Chapter 59 of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Act already provides information and enforcement capabilities that would, we believe, enable the state of Oregon to continue to progress reasonably, moderately, consistent with national standards. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jim Temple. I'm a vice president with Home Street Bank, a community bank based out of Seattle. I'm also a member of the OMLA, and I'm here today to try to give you a real brief kind of overview of the situation from a banking perspective or from a bank's perspective. And first of all, bad loans are bad business. Banks do not intentionally set out to make a bad loan. All you need to do is look at the newspaper or look at any of the news agencies lately, and you can see the hundreds of millions of dollars that banks are now writing off because of the loans that have been made. I don't know how one would define good business, but writing off hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars in bad loans is not in any bank's good interest. Even on a very micro level, on an individual loan, we can spend tens of thousands of dollars in lost interest, legal fees, counseling, et cetera, and trying to help that borrower. And actually, once we've even repossessed the home, we can spend tens of thousands of dollars in real estate fees and other costs to then sell that home. We do not want to make bad loans. We are not in that business. Obviously, we've made bad loans. How did that happen? There's lots of reasons it happened. I can't deny the profitability and the urge for more business is one of them. But certainly another reason is the response to the community housing organizations across the country that have virtually demanded over the years that we loosen our underwriting standards, that we come up with more flexible loan programs, and we come up with more creative ways to help more people buy housing. Certainly we attempted to do that. Many of the people that were applauding our efforts 3 or 4 years ago when these products first hit the market are now condemning us for doing it. I think it's obvious that some of these products were excessive. But somewhere in between there's a balance. Somewhere out there we do not want to go back to the more restrictive lending standards that we had in the past, but there's a balance between the excessively flexible ones that we've had recently and the conservative ones that will allow the most people to buy houses and own a home in the state of Oregon. While there's a large need and a demand right now for some sort of action, we would urge you to move cautiously. The mortgage lending industry is a highly regulated environment at this point. We have entire departments of people who do nothing but analyze the rules and regulations that exist today and try to advise us on how to act and do business in a way that's going to meet all the rules and follow the regulations that we're required to have. What we need right now is a partnership between government and the industry to clarify and simplify our environment. We need to help people. We need to make it easier for people to own homes. We need to make it easier for people to get into homes with loans that they understand and they can afford. And we would urge you to move in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both of you. Mr. Williams. Todd, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Good morning. My name is Todd Williams. I am a past president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. I am almost a 20-year industry veteran, and I am our current government affairs chair, and I appreciate both the chair's time and the committee's today. I'll make my comments fairly brief and try and be as direct and straightforward as I can. First of all, OAMP wants to help consumers get the best mortgage for their individual needs. And I don't think that is disputed if you watch what happens out in the marketplace with the whopping majority of our members. Word-of-mouth advertising is the primary way we get our business. And if, as an originator, which is what I am for a living, I write loans every day in addition to running a firm. I meet with customers face-to-face, just like I'm meeting with you here today. I look in the whites of their eyes, and we have discussions about their finances. I can tell you that if I did a bad job of that, or if I was not operating in their best interest and creating products or pushing or steering them into something that was not appropriate, I wouldn't have customers for very long. Second of all, a very key piece. The mortgage originator, frankly, whether he works for a bank or a mortgage brokerage firm or a mortgage bank or any other delivery system, is not the individual or entity that is creating the guidelines under which loans are approved or declined. I don't have a magic pen that gets to choose which loans we do and which loans we don't. There's a specific reason the lending industry for, well, longer than I've been in it, separates the sales or loan officer piece from the underwriting piece. It's a very separate world. Another key piece I want to make very clear. Like any other industry and any other market and market cycle, you have a run-up and you have a run-down. Economic cycles are the same. Our business is the same. As we had a hot market, everybody wanted to get in. We had real estate values going up, and we had new products coming to market like any other business. As that tide has turned some, especially in areas outside of Oregon, clearly hindsight is 20/20, and there are products that were there that did not do the individual, the loan officer, the bank, or the consumer did not serve the ultimate purpose of both getting people in homes, keeping people in homes, and having performing loans, which is a lender we all want. That top piece isn't going to get fixed by this body. The market has already fixed that situation. The key products that were talked about by both the folks from Osberg, the data in the CRL, and the data from our Oregon, I can sit here today and tell you as a loan officer trying to find homes, lenders that will fund, underwrite, approve, and fund certain types of loans, that at least 99.9, if not 100%, of primary products that we're talking about here today do not exist in the marketplace. The marketplace has already made that move. If you are a borrower and you are trying to get a zero down loan and you have marginal credit and or you can't document your income, you're not getting a loan today. If you're a marginal borrower and you have less than 20% down payment, you aren't getting a loan today. If you are able to get a subprime loan, the chances that a 228 loan are available in the marketplace today, or if you did any homework on what you were getting, you would rapidly find that the product no longer exists or a better product exists at the same interest rate. 5-year fixed, 7-year fixed, 30-year fixed product. A lot of that is already taken care of. If you're an investor and you're buying properties and trying to flip them, or you're doing limited documentation loans, I have customers' files on my desk today that are extremely creditworthy, have solid down payments, are trying to buy second homes and investment properties, cannot document their income the way a typical W-2 wage earner does, and that person is having extreme difficulty getting a loan at any interest rate today. As a professional that meets with customers every day, I can tell you these are facts. If you'd like me to give you loan files and examples, I can do that. As an industry, here's some things that we think will help prevent and help keep our industry on the improving track, not on the declining track. First and foremost, we believe in loan originator licensing. We believe that we should be regulating the people that are meeting with these customers, not the products. The products will be taken care of by the marketplace as they have been this time. Second of all, by licensing loan originators, the one key situation that we have that I've seen in almost 20 years in this business is a rogue individual working for one firm, causing problems, damaging consumers, creating loan losses for lenders. That person is either fired or leaves and walks across the street and goes to work for another firm. Without some way to give that person a name and a number and kick them out of the business, we can't stop that practice. It will continue and continue and continue. Almost all other financial service providers are individually licensed and regulated so that as you have bad apples and rogue players, you can pluck them from the system. The OAMP has come to this body three different times asking for more regulation of our industry. Pretty unheard of from a trade association. We're asking for it again. We'd like to get there. We'd like to have every originator, regardless of the delivery channel, regulated and licensed so that they can't bounce in and out of Statute 59 regulation. We also know that right now that's a very difficult road to hoe, and we know it'll be a process. We think that everybody in every mortgage office should have background checks from the receptionist up. They have access to our borrower's financial information. We have computers in today's world, and they have access to that information. If you're a customer at my firm, I want to make sure that the receptionist at my firm has been checked at every company, and that we at least know they haven't been convicted of fraud or other financial crimes. We think that advertising regulation is a key to this piece. A very good share of the most egregious acts that have come across my desk and that you'll hear about in these testimonies and you heard about it in Senate Bill 965 came from not personal referrals but from mass advertising and oftentimes advertising from out-of-state licensees and out-of-state exempt institutions. Hey, come get this great loan with a 1.9% rate fixed. Well, we know that isn't the case. Right now the division is understaffed and does not have the teeth to go after some of these perpetrators at the level that we need to. If our advertising more accurately reflected what the individual was truly offering, some of these people would not be in the situations that they're in. A couple of pieces that were specifically talked about in some of the testimony I want to cover also. As you know, we're part of the Mortgage Lending Work Group. We've been very impressed with that. And for the first time, we've seen all of the players come together and try and work through a legitimate solution that actually solves some of the problems, not creates others. One of the things that Ms. Martin spoke about with her one prospective customer and the $1,000 payment, one of the biggest issues we have in the state is we have an affordability problem. We have homes more expensive than the average income, the median income. That's not going to change, folks. And products like interest-only loans and negative amortization loans, properly structured and set up for the right person, can be a great way to help people that normally couldn't afford a home in a certain market get started, build equity, work their way into more traditional products. Without that, they're on the outside looking in forever. And if a person thought that they could afford what sounds like a $300,000 or $400,000 loan with a $1,000 payment, they should know better. They should be reading some of those documents. Another comment was made about kickbacks. Well, I can tell you sitting right here now, a kickback is a Section 8 federal RESPA violation. And anybody that calls them anything else other than that is not giving you the straight scoop. Our industry operates on an ethical manner, and the mortgage brokerage industry is the only delivery channel that discloses yield spread premium, which is exactly what Osberg is talking about when they're addressing issues of kickbacks. We're the only one that discloses it to the borrower right up front and at the end of both. Another piece was about reining in damaging practices. Again, if we're regulating the people and not the products, and we have some tools, if the DFCS and the Attorney General's Office have the tools to rein these people in, we can resolve a significant amount of these issues. Finally, I want to remind us that as we go through this, that any regulation that's created here at the state level will only have jurisdiction over roughly 50% of the mortgages originated in this state. Oregon mortgage brokers and small mortgage bankers originate about 50% of the loans nationally, and the number is pretty close within our state as well. All exempt institutions, none of what we do is covered. So it's very important, since we're out there on the streets working to create good loans and fund good loans for consumers, that we don't put those key people that are doing good work for our consumers at a distinct financial and legislative disadvantage to the exempt institutions. Lastly, I know that this is a two-part project from the lending group, the Mortgage Loan Working Group. We very much believe that addressing some of the foreclosure rescue scams and looking at some of the issues we can deal with for consumers that will help those that we can help. And there's a significant group that we can't help and to some extent shouldn't help. The market is the market. People make decisions. They put risk capital out there. They made that decision. But if we can help some of these people, we would very much like to do that. Going forward for the 09 session, we very much want to get together with some of these other issues, loan originator licensing and some of the other things we've talked about, so that we can better protect consumers, so that when an individual does go in front of a loan officer, they at least know that individual's had some background checks, has a basic level of education, and if they do wrong, they're going to get punished for it. Not, oh, just go to work next door and everything's fine. Thank you so much for the chance to speak with you today, and I appreciate your time.
Todd, thank you. And just, I agree with 85 or 90% of your testimony. The one exception, in fact, I even agree with this, but it's semantics. Your reference to this body not being able to address some of the issues because the market has already taken care of them. I do think the market has responded, but that's like saying, okay, we're going to pull one slide out of a motion picture reel, look at that cell and say, okay, that's where we are, and we're past that in the movie. No, our job in this committee is to make sure we're addressing the end of the movie because the market will come back.
Absolutely.
And those products will resurface.
Absolutely.
And I think part of it is product regulation. But the bulk of it, you are absolutely correct, is people regulation. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Very good. We, last and certainly not least, and then we'll throw it open for questions, Hope DiCarlo. From DiCarlo Law. See, I'm a mind reader. I know these things. Enter and sign in, please.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Westland, Chair Holby. I'm Hope DiCarlo. I'm a private practice consumer lawyer, and I work in Portland. I'm here to give you my perspective as someone who represents Oregon borrowers in litigation against the mortgage industry. As a lawyer who represents borrowers, I get the jackhammer.
Make a point.
Yeah. I'll just move it closer. I see an unmistakable pattern of abuse in the subprime mortgage market. The pattern begins with sales practices, and it continues through lenders' application and underwriting processes, and it culminates in loans with costs and terms that can literally destroy people's lives. The loans that concern me most are not purchase money loans, but high-cost, high-fee refinances made without the lender taking adequate care to be sure that the borrower can afford the loan. In Oregon, it is these subprime refinances that I'm talking about when I use the phrase predatory lending. Most often, borrowers who end up with these loans tell me that they were not looking to refinance before they got the loan. Instead, the refi came looking for them.
Homeowners are being cold called by salespeople, brokers, and lenders who apply pressure to refinance in order to consolidate other debt, usually unsecured debt. Sometimes mortgage companies promise to lower existing payments or interest rates. Often my clients find that after the refi closes, they're worse off than they were before. When borrowers find themselves unable to make their payments, sometimes they become victims of repeated refinancing, sometimes even 3, 4, or 5 times in about as many years. Every time they refinance, another $5,000 to $12,000 of their home equity goes into the pockets of brokers and lenders. This is in the form of finance fees and costs. Predictably, the borrowers who usually end up with these loans are vulnerable people. The recently divorced, single parents, the elderly, the sick and the disabled, and those with little education. Sometimes they own their home free and clear and find themselves on the verge of losing it after a series of improvidently made loans. The nature of mortgages is so technical that borrowers don't understand the risky nature of the credit they're being offered. And personally, I can say that mortgages even intimidate lawyers, very few of whom feel competent to look at loan documents and give advice, even on how they're going to amortize and be paid off. It's no wonder that even educated, competent people with good credit depend on the honesty of brokers and lenders who arrange their loans. People expect mortgage lenders to be careful about helping them select a loan product that won't get them in trouble. But Oregon law currently creates no duty for mortgage industry players to protect borrowers' interests. In fact, brokers' interests usually run counter to borrowers. Their commissions often scale with the price of the loans they sell. In other words, the higher the interest rate, the higher the fees, the more brokers get paid. Adjustable rate mortgages have been the most common type of subprime loan I've seen since 2000. However, in the last few years, a troubling new trend has begun. Almost every set of loan documents I've seen from a borrower since August 2006 has been the kind that industry analysts are now calling alternative or non-traditional mortgage products, payment option ARMs, and interest-only loans. Loans with payments that will radically increase at set intervals, and loans that are likely to accrue interest faster than families can pay it off, what's known as negative amortization. These products have the practical effect of eroding borrowers' ownership stake in their home, and very few borrowers understand that that's what they've gotten into. Alternative loans often contain prepayment penalties, which have been mentioned before, that amount to thousands of dollars, which make it difficult or impossible for a borrower with little equity to get a better loan. Aside from requiring disclosure, Oregon law does nothing to soften the harsh effects of prepayment penalties. In 2004, I was one of a team of lawyers who represented a Portland couple who fell victim to a bad loan. A Multnomah County jury found that lender liable for $500,000 in punitive damages because of its conduct. And the jury's verdict was reinstated this year by the Oregon Court of Appeals. And if you want to see the full opinion, you can see it on the Oregon Judicial Department's website. It's called Vasquez Lopez versus Beneficial Oregon. Just search for the name. I have the full site in my written testimony. This case was the first of its kind in Oregon, and the verdict shows that Oregonians will not tolerate businesses who engage in fraud. But though it took a trial and a trip to the appellate court to find relief, the Vasquez Lopez family was actually lucky in a way. They were the victims of illegal behavior that was clear and overt enough to be actionable under existing law. But many Oregon families are saddled with destructive loans and no such legal remedy. Most of the lending practices that put family homes at risk are perfectly legal in our state. I have no doubt that the borrowers that I represent are just the tip of the iceberg. I'm a part-time lawyer. I don't advertise. I don't even have a listed business phone number. I get all my cases by referral. I know my clients are not special cases, though, because they're not borrowers with loan products that are one of a kind, that are custom made for them. Their loans are made by national lenders on form documents. For every person whose loan documents I see, I'm confident that there are hundreds of others who were solicited by the same broker for the same dangerous loan product. My clients and the other borrowers who found lawyers who are willing to sue lenders have a fighting chance, but not all homeowners should have to count on their day in court. Homeowners need the law on their side the day they sign their loan papers, not when they're on the verge of foreclosure. I'm worried about those borrowers I don't see with loans that are just like my clients, loans with abusive terms that are illegal in other states but allowed here in Oregon. Without fair lending laws, borrowers are finding themselves in places that people go when they end up desperate. They're applying for yet another refinance, they're working long hours, they're getting second jobs, they're compromising their health and their family relationships. Or maybe they're finding themselves filing bankruptcy,
responding to ads by foreclosure rescue operations, some of them will certainly lose their homes, either selling at a loss, deeding their home to the lender through what's known as a deed in lieu of foreclosure, or through a foreclosure sale. There's no other way to help these borrowers and those that will inevitably follow in their footsteps except by creating tougher mortgage laws here in Oregon. Without more protective laws, borrowers will increasingly find themselves stuck in impossible loans. The growing trend toward home loss will undermine the fabric of citizens' lives, our families, and our neighborhoods. I ask that the legislature help curtail these problems by creating mortgage laws that rein in mortgage brokers, regulate underwriting, provide specific underwriting standards for affordability, and prohibit unfair loan terms. Thank you for the honor of testifying here.
Oh, thank you. Now we can start to reverse this process, and we have ended right on time. I didn't even have to give you the two finger. But anyway, so let's open this up for questions. And if I could ask some of our testifiers, no, Hope, don't go away. You're on the hot seat for sure now.
Can we have another question?
No. The... maybe just have some of our testifiers come forward and just be ready for questions as they might arise. Does anyone have questions for Hope?
I do. Hope, you mentioned that the people that you're seeing are coming in with these packages that are basically these alternatives. I mean, are the more traditional products packages not being made available, or just because of their financial situation, they're not even able to consider those?
Well, I don't know that I can exactly say what the cause is. The borrowers that I see are, I don't think that they have, they usually, like I said, they're usually refinances that they've found, and they probably haven't shopped around very much. Usually what happens is the loan comes to them, and they're convinced to refinance, thinking that what they're getting is a better deal. I haven't seen that, I've never heard of a situation where a borrower is offered a range of options and realizes they can't qualify for the better one, so has to take the bad one. Usually it's sort of a, here's what you get situation.
Okay.
Suzanne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question I'd like to ask somebody from the industry, Todd, for example, and then one of the consumer advocates. I don't think there's any question that a lot of the products in question have come off the market, at least for now, and many of them are likely to come back. But there's a whole bunch of people out there right now who qualified for and got the subprime loans and are in them now and are facing a payment adjustment. But because the products aren't on the market now, when it's time for them to refinance, let's talk about what's going to happen to them. And I'm not talking about the people who were steered to a subprime loan who would have qualified for something else, but the people who got a subprime loan because that's what they qualified for. And so now they're facing a huge payment increase and they want to refinance. And let's even set aside the issue of prepayment penalties. Let's just talk about what's going to happen to them because the products aren't on the market now.
Okay.
You
okay.
First. You may come.
Sure.
Yeah, need it on the record.
Okay.
The primary things that have...
Todd, for the record.
Oh, Todd Williams, OAMP. Is that what you wanted?
Yep.
Okay. The primary things that I think you're seeing, I'm seeing sitting in front of customers every day, is that, one, the more mainstream products have allowed some flexibility to give us some room to get some of these people in other products. The underwriting engines, Fannie Mae's engine, Freddie Mac's engine, some of the proprietary investors, Countrywide, Wells Fargo, etc., have created what we call... expanded or Alt-A or A-minus risk level products that they'll fill in their own conventional portfolio and still at higher loan to values. Secondly, FHA product has become much more popular again for multiple reasons. And as many of you may know, federal government is currently trying to make some adjustments to the FHA pool to include or absorb more of the exact loan products or loan borrowers for whom you're speaking. One of the big issues we have here in Oregon is FHA has a loan limit like most conventional lenders. We have an unaffordable market. A lot of those loans are larger than will fit in the FHA portfolio. We're looking for some relief there. We're also trying to change some terms of who can originate FHA loans so that we can get that product out to some of those very people. Some of the subprime lenders, and I'll pick one primary player here in the state of Oregon, Option One, has agreed to refinance an existing borrower so long as they are current on their mortgage into a longer term, similarly risk-adjusted loan. Instead of a 228, a five-year fix, for example. And in fact, they no longer do 228s or 327s. 525 or five-year fixed is the shortest maturity they'll do on any A-minus or lower grade product. And they're making adjustments with prepays and so forth. They are a servicer. So that's what we're seeing for those borrowers that should have gotten a loan to begin with and have serviced that loan to the best of their ability and are trying to honor their commitments and trying to secure a more appropriate product in the current market. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
From scrupulous professional lenders, that's the market approach at this juncture.
That should always be the market approach.
Yeah. But, okay, people being people. Angela, did you have a comment? And I'm sorry, Paul, I cut you off.
For the record, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. A couple of comments. Chair Westland, I think you said it best when you said that the market will come back. The market has a very short memory. The market actually hasn't faded to the degree that we'd like to believe. We're seeing some good modifications. I'm making reference to the countrywide rate sheet, which was made available in September. It's the last time I looked at it. And that rate sheet showed that some modifications had happened, but the underlying riskiness of the loan product still existed. So instead of a 228, it's a 528. Well, we're going to keep you in that loan for the first 5 years at a rate you may be able to afford, and then it's going to explode after those first 5 years. So it's a different type of loan with a longer-term risk involved. When the market comes back, if we do nothing to address the moral hazards that exist, more people will get into yet another bad loan. What happens to the people who are facing reset? Well, I made reference in my testimony earlier that as many as 1 in 5 subprime borrowers qualified for a better interest loan when they took out their loan. We need a law that avoids steering so that 1 in 5 borrowers do have the best loan available to them when they go to refinance. For many people, subprime home ownership was the way to improve their credit. So as they go to look out into the market, they can hope to become prime customers. But again, we have to make sure that the marketplace is catching them with strong consumer protection. So not everyone's going to survive. We know that we're going to see people face home loss. What we're working to do is to mitigate that loss as best as possible.
I have one quick follow-up and one brief comment. My quick follow-up is to Mr. Carlo. I wonder if you could just briefly describe the loan that was at issue in the beneficial case. And then my comment is, even though it may be industry standard, I think it's very confusing to consumers to refer to something as a fixed-rate loan because it doesn't adjust for 2 or 5 years. I think that's really confusing to consumers. They think a fixed-rate loan is something that stays fixed for the length of the loan. But I hear discussion in the industry that it's a fixed-rate mortgage because it doesn't adjust for 2 years or it doesn't adjust for 5 years. So I just wanted to put that out there from a consumer point of view. I think that's confusing. And then if you could address that.
Sure. The loan that the Vasquez-Lopez family got was... it was a loan at about a 13% interest rate, and I don't believe it was one of the new types of non-traditional adjustable loans. I think it was one of the more conventional arms. It replaced a loan, however, that was a 7% loan. These were prime borrowers who were stuck in a subprime loan without realizing that's what had happened to them.
Thank you.
Can I make one quick comment to bring up a piece that Angela brought that I think is important? One of the things that the OAMP has done addressing when borrowers are looking at refinancing, especially if they are on this bubble of can I get a loan to get out of the loan I have not have now or not, is we've created a suitability and net tangible benefit form worksheet for loan originators, for our members, to sit down with a consumer and go through. Let's sit down and figure out if this is really to your benefit or not, and if so, how, and what that individual's key goals they're trying to get out of that refinance are. Are they trying to pull out cash out to pay out their debt? Are they just trying to lower the existing payment they have? Are they trying to combine a first and a second loan together into one? Various reasons could exist. We've created that form so that our members and our originators, and we're happy to share it with anybody who wants it, can use that so the customer can sit down and go, this is why I'm doing this. This is the benefit or lack thereof of the choices that's in front of them. And I think that's very important on refinance loans.
Could you please get a copy of that, too? I think that...
Absolutely.
I know I'd like to see it. The
rest it has to be ratified by our board, which is scheduled to happen here in the next week or so. And as soon as that is, I'll get it to you.
You know, I say this only half facetiously. Sounds like, Todd, you and Angela could walk out in that hall and solve this whole thing in about 10 minutes. So we'll wait.
Have you had lunch yet?
Chair Holby.
Oh, thanks. I'm going to defer to Senator Devlin. I'll have my opportunities again tomorrow.
Ms. Navarro from the Oregon Bankers, if you'd come forward.
Why do you guys stay close?
It's like,
it's like a game show.
It's like Hollywood Squares.
Survivor.
My first question might be better posed to some of the previous people that were here testifying, but I want to get them both on the record. That is, the first one is, we've talked about mortgage lending and in terms of the incentive to sell a product that is of higher cost to the consumer. Now, I'll probably get you back to respond to that. And that there's a problem with that. Well, I'm having difficulty with that from the standpoint that every time I think of a arm's length transaction between a consumer and a seller, the role of the seller isn't to give the consumer the lowest price for the product. Ms. Jarvis back there, who represents realtors, most agents are sellers' agents. Their price is not to sell the home for the lowest price. Their price is to get the highest price for the seller. A car dealer doesn't want his salespeople or her salespeople selling their vehicles for the lowest price to the consumer. So I'm having a problem that there is a problem with the mortgage industry because the loan originators are basically trying to make more profit. There's a consumer side of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the consumer side is consumers make choices. And somewhere there's a consumer responsibility in this. And I just wanted to get that on the record. You don't have to comment. They may want to comment on that. Somewhere the consumer has a responsibility here too. But then I'm going to ask a question that's on the other side of this. You made a statement. We've had a lot of very broad statements here without a lot of specifics of sound underwriting practices. When is it a sound underwriting practice to give a mortgage to a borrower when you know that in 2 years when it resets, or 3 years when it resets, they cannot afford to pay the mortgage?
I don't have to answer now.
Come out there like you're saying something.
It's just a basic dilemma in my mind. But if you're saying sound underwriting practices, I cannot envision where it is sound to be giving a loan to someone that you know will not be able to afford to meet the requirements of that loan 2 to 3 years down the road.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, I agree with you. I don't think it's sound to make a loan to a borrower that you know cannot repay that loan in 2 years down the road. And in our highly regulated industry, we do, you would find, if you talk to the members of my organization, consider a borrower's ability to repay. In fact, when I talk to our members, things like no documentation loans don't, I can't say they've never occurred in the banking sector, but they don't occur regularly among Oregon banks and certainly those supervised by the state of Oregon. And they do consider, in fact, I've had numerous conversations lately about what underwriting practices are for our banks, and consideration of the borrower's ability to repay is a fundamental piece of that. I can't answer for everyone. I can answer for the membership that I represent.
I think one of the things that we're struggling with here is the noise in the background. But the other is that there are two elements of this that seem pretty straightforward. One of them is the issue of prepayment penalties and when those potentially might go away. The other is what we do about so-called rescue mortgages. But the third one is, do we do anything in law about determining what is sound underwriting practice? I think that's the most controversial of those three.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I think I forgot to state too, I'm Linda Navarro with the Oregon Bankers Association. We have numerous, as Pam Levitt from the Credit Union Association stated, we are federally insured institutions and as such have numerous regulatory requirements at the federal level. Even if we're state chartered and supervised by the state of Oregon, we're subject to all the federal regulations imposed on the banking industry, which include a number of regulations with regard to how loans are underwritten. And when examiners come into banks regularly, they look at the soundness of that institution and their underwriting practices. So I believe that for the institutions I represent, there is sufficient regulation about how we underwrite loans. And I at this point, haven't seen a proposal at the state level, but I would suggest that our focus is better on those areas of law that are not regulated to the satisfaction of this committee or to the benefit of consumers, like the mortgage rescue schemes. I'm not looking to deflect from our industry, but I think if you dive into the differences in different types of loan originators and where the regulations lie, you'll find, at least in the case of the banking industry that I speak for, it's already highly regulated how a bank underwrites those loans. So, again, I think to really digest this, and I'm not in a position today to present any specifics, but you'd really need to look at where are those loans that are the high-risk loans with perhaps weaker underwriting standards, no doc loans, high loan-to-value ratios. Where are those loans being funded?
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to first let Mike Riley know how sorry I am. He'll have to listen to this tape. And I just wanted to make a comment about something that Laura Etherton had in her testimony, and she can respond to this or somebody else can. I appreciate Senator Devlin saying that we certainly have a lot of broad statements here. I know we have a huge issue here to get our arms around. Many people in this room are more confident of their prophecy of what's going to happen than I am. But I want to get a hold of the number in Oregon. So my question, Laura, when you say... Well, first of all, you heard Janet Jarvis's testimony, and I wondered, between lease buyback scams, bait and switch, and phantom help, which do you prefer? No, I'm just kidding. But I want to know if what 50% of foreclosure rates are up compared to a year ago. What does that mean in numbers?
Chair, member of the committee, Representative Gilliam. Again, this is Laura Etherton. I'm actually looking at Associated Press article reporting on the data released last Thursday by RealtyTrack, which has about it has Oregon at about in the middle of the pack regarding other states, but then even just within Oregon, looking at the foreclosure rates for September of last year versus September of this year, the numbers are 50% higher regarding folks who are, you know, typically 60 to 90 days behind on their payments and are in that sort of danger zone. And I think, you know, overall, you know, there's a lot of different perspectives to look at the place where borrowers are, especially if you know, that's all that's not just subprime. That's, you know, that's looking at everybody who has a mortgage. What are the rates of foreclosure right now? So I think it's one factor that just goes, what were those numbers last year? What are they this year?
Oh, I agree.
Higher. So it's an area for concern. I think that it's important for us to look, you know, at each of these pieces, what the piece of the subprime piece, you know, what that component is, you know, as we look for what are the practices, whether it's the people getting regulated, the products getting regulated, and so I think that's just a piece there.
Mr. Chair, just to follow, I agree, it's an important piece. What I'm trying to get at is, what does that 50% mean in Oregon? How many foreclosures are we talking about? How many families are affected? And if somebody's just got a ballpark figure, that's fine. I just don't know what 50% means in terms of Oregonians.
Okay. It's about 980 homes had begun the foreclosure process in September, and that's about one of every 1,600 Oregon households. And that's according to RealtyTrack.
Okay.
Chair, Representative Gilliam, some of these numbers are provided for you on page 16 of the...
Angela Martin, for the record.
Sorry. Angela Martin. On page 16 of the Center for Responsible Lending testimony, and what we see, the numbers that I believe are similar to what Laura Etherton are referencing, in the second quarter of 2006, 557 subprime loans had entered foreclosure. Second quarter 2007, 969 foreclosures. So you can look at some of the historical numbers there. And, again, we'll have a better look at the data when the work of the data subcommittee is available, and it will include household numbers because I think percents alone don't give us the full picture. So
that helps. Thank you.
You know, is there anyone in the room that hasn't signed up to testify or was on the agenda that wishes to testify for a few moments?
We got a taker.
I knew I shouldn't ask that question. Come on up. Don't be bashful. We're short of time. If you want to say something.
I just got a little something to say.
I was going to raise my hand at that question. No, you wait till tomorrow.
For the record, Shane Jackson, Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators. I represent a group of mortgage brokers and originators. We are not in coalition with any credit unions or banks. We just stand for mortgage brokers in the industry in Oregon. I wanted to just refer to the subprime loan industry and the two-year ARMs and what's occurred is that a lot of people were offered these two-year ARMs because they live on the cash economy. These are mechanics, waitresses, self-employed carpenters who don't have a lot of equity and don't qualify for what's called automated lending systems. They did qualify for these ARMs. Now, but what happens, though, is after 2 years of making good, clean payments on these ARMs, they do qualify for automated lending mortgages, FHA-backed loans. So they can, by making 2 years of good payments, they can now transfer into a 30-year fix. The difficulty occurs here with the prepay. If they were able to negotiate, and if their mortgage broker, which they should have, negotiate a soft prepay, they can roll that prepay into the new mortgage. If it's a hard prepay, they have to kick up a little dough and pay off that prepay. The Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators favors more loans being structured as soft prepay, and we would support legislation that allows soft prepay. California does that too. That's it. Any questions?
Any quick questions for Shane?
If I may, I'm sorry, since I've been in both committees, I don't know if this was covered before. Soft prepay versus hard prepay, I'm assuming hard means you have to pay a certain amount before you can transfer out and
start
to be confident. Installments?
Correct. Well, you can
roll it into the loan.
It has to be satisfied out, not necessarily built into the next loan. It has to be satisfied by yourself with a hard prepay.
How much money are we talking about in these prepays?
Usually about $2,000 to $4,000.
Okay.
It depends on, again, depends on the size of
right.
the loan. But when you have people who live on the cash economy, which a lot of people do, and they only qualify for these things, this is something that they often know about, that their mortgage broker lets them know, look, you're going to have this prepay set up before we go to automated lending. I have a good friend, Tu Phan, who used to work for Willamette Mortgage Group, and now he works for Premier Mortgage Group. He can't write these loans fast enough, 30-year loan fixed fast enough out of his people that he's built a relationship. He's advertised for 9 years in the Asian Reporter, works with a lot of people who live on the cash economy. He can't write them fast enough. He's putting people into 30-year fix as fast as he can write them because they've hit every payment on a 2-year ARM.
Okay. Dr. Holvey, are you ready?
I am. Thank you. I was going to recognize myself, and I think I just have a couple of comments as we move forward on this topic. I Representative Glizio left me a note that he had a question, and he was looking for a distinction between some of the terms that have been used in exotic loan products, subprime mortgages, and you know, I don't think we've really, you know, talked about definitions of some of these terms specifically, so it might be something that we can address at the task force. And that brings to mind that I hope the task force will bring us back some recommendations on legislation they think we should take action on in February, some we should work on in 2009. And in that context, I think it's important that we recognize what we can do and what we can agree on, but also I'd like kind of different organizations, because I've heard a lot of different opinions about what the problems are. We've heard about excessive products, loan products. You know, is that something? I mean, these are just some basic questions. Does your organization believe there's a problem with them first? And if so, is there legislation needed to deal with it? The same thing would be true with lending practices and underwriting standards. I hear that, you know, we have underwriting standards that we adhere to at the federal level, but obviously not everybody adheres to those. So should the state codify underwriting standards or look at lending practices in general that we should be putting legislation forward on? You know, that's, I guess, sort of a yes-no question. If so, what should it look like? Foreclosure laws, looking at enhanced disclosure and things like that. Licensing as well. I heard that was a concern. Should we do more around registration or licensing and giving some more tools to our enforcement arms to deal with some of these things? So we're, and then of course mortgage rescue seems to be, you know, something that everybody, the mortgage rescue scam seems to hit everybody's note that we need to do something about. So basically I'd like to see that discussion perhaps go to the task force and have a discussion. You know, do people agree that there's a problem in loan products? If so, should we have limits on them? Do people agree that there's a problem with lending practices? If so, what should we do? And the same with Mortgage Rescue and a few other things, just so we can get kind of everybody's point of view, because I don't think it was inherently clear in testimony whether people felt that we needed to do something in certain areas or not. And I guess I would just leave it at that, and I look forward to the committee hearing back from the task force on what their ideas are around solutions and legislation going forward. Leave it at that. Thank you.
We have a gentleman that I think has an intimate knowledge of all of this that might want to say something. Sir, we are limited in time, but we very much appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Sign in, please.
For the record, my name is Bob Barney. My wife and I are here. We're the couple that are paying $1,000 a month for the $300,000 house. I've been listening to the testimony, and I'm kind of torn because some of what Mr. Williams said, I looked at myself and I thought, well, geez, you know, he's kind of right. How stupid could I be to do something like that? And then something that Senator Devlin said, yeah, I guess he's right. These guys are trying to make a buck. I'm just thinking to myself, if I'm going to get on a bus and go to Seattle, I believe that I have a reasonable expectation of getting there safely, because the guy's got a bus driver uniform on and he's got a driver's license. He's getting paid to do this, and he wants to get there just as safely as I do. Well, what about if a person has a license to sell real estate and loan you money? Is responsibility the key term here? Am I too stupid to know that this guy is the same as if I bought a car out of the paper? Or do I have a reasonable expectation to trust the person with a license? It's probably a rhetorical question, but I believe that the people that are selling these products have a responsibility. And except for the product itself, which we turns out we needed that product to get into this beautiful home that we're going to lose, I don't think the product, the problem is the product. It's the responsibility. How honest are the people that are authorized to throw it around? Thank you. That's all I needed to say.
Mr. Barney,
fitting end.
Thank you so very much for being here. And I think you've summed up exactly, more articulately than all of our expert witnesses. You did very well. And good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Anything for the good of the order? I think we've had an excellent first meeting. Thank all the committee members for being here and your participation. You know, this is kind of the three-dimensional Rubik's Cube thing, and this is a little bit about what Mr. Barney was saying. You know, on one hand, if you want to crater Oregon, over-regulate and disincent the mortgage lending industry. Probably the worst thing we could do. On the other hand, you know, we've got unscrupulous individuals slipping through the cracks, selling products that actually make things worse for people that were, you know, in desperate straits to begin with. And then you complicate all that by the fact that we've got lenders that are regulated by Oregon law, national lenders, and then offshore lenders. You know, we've got to bring all that together as a committee. By golly, with your help, we're going to do it. We appreciate you being here. The Senate committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Senator Westland. And we will be meeting again before November 15th. I do know that. And with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Interim House Committee on Consumer Protection.